All right. If we can get going, that would be helpful. Welcome everyone to 2008, a new year, and veterans are going to have a lot of attention this year. And welcome to all the guests in the audience, too, on behalf of Senator Vickerman and myself, Representative Conan's the chair of the subcommittee on veterans, and I think Representative Tremba's en route yet. We welcome you all to the meeting. Just housekeeping briefly, on the agenda, what we're going to do this morning, till about noon or little after, unless we get done sooner, we'll be looking at the Veterans Long-Term Care Advisory Commission report, and then we're going to break for lunch. For those of you that aren't familiar, just down the hall in the next building, there's a lunchroom. So you don't have to go far if you want to eat on premises. You can do that, and then we will reconvene 1:30-ish or so probably for the afternoon, which will then be the mental health, veterans mental health care report that we asked for in legislation last year. So. And then we hope to be done and out of here by 2:30 or 3, I would say, this afternoon. So those that need to head home will still have plenty of time. There's restrooms, again, for those that don't know, on either side, right out in the hall. And I think that's it for housekeeping. Again, just a couple introductory comments. Oh, yeah, one more thing, which I forgot, too. Shut off your cell phones or put them on silent. In our committee, Senator Vickerman, what we do is usually have a can. I don't see it here. And if your cell phone rings during our committee, you have to put a buck in the can for coffee. And if you answer the cell phone, it's $5. So that's how we work it here. And you've all been in church or meetings. It's bad enough when they ring, but the people go, hello, and they start talking, you know. So,
Is that even for senators?
Yeah, and for senators, too. Senators, it might be double.
Mr. Junkie, we've got our members trained. You just say you don't use them, you don't use them. We don't have that problem.
I see. Vickerman doesn't own a cell phone, is what he's saying. So anyway, out of a courtesy, if you'd silence your cell phones, that'd be helpful. Again, welcome. What we're doing here today, as you all know, there was a the governor set up a long-term care advisory commission for veterans, and they met during the interim, and they put together a report. Some of those members are sitting around the table that were part of that commission, and certainly we're going to look forward to hearing from them on some of their thoughts. But we know we have to make some adjustments and modernize veterans care in this state. And certainly a lot of focus has been on the Minneapolis facility last few years, but frankly, I think we as a group are more interested in taking a statewide look at veterans care, not only health care, but also mental health care, delivery of that care, delivery of services, availability of services. I think we want to make sure that availability is there across the state for veterans. And frankly, I think I speak for the group and the legislature. We'd like to make Minnesota a model that the rest of the nation looks and points and says, that's how we do veteran services. And I think that's probably the goal of everyone around here. And if we can keep that in mind over the next year and 2 years as we move into a budget session again, not this year but next, I think that'll be helpful. And I hope some of these things lay the groundwork for that today is why we are meeting. And I think it's important that we all get the similar information. And so we've got the Senate here, too. Senator Vickerman, anything you'd like to say before we call up the...
Thank all my members for showing up here today and taking part in this discussion. As this moved along, there were some bad feelings and bad reports and whatnot took place. And so they put together, the governor, this advisory commission report. And I'm happy to say that Senator Erin Robes, I put her on the lead because she's involved in health care more than maybe I have. So I'm looking forward to this today. Just remember, this is just one step in a lot of steps we're going to have to take for veterans. So we'll start out with this. This afternoon we'll have do more of a brain injury, which I'm very key on. And then we'll see what happens. So Mr. Chair, I think we should move right along. There's lots to discuss here today, and looking forward to it.
Okay. Anyone else, anything to say before we start? Everyone's good? Okay, any comments? All right. So if we get the witness or witnesses, I don't know how many are presenting, who's up? Dale Thompson. It's like he's coming solo. You're a brave man. Welcome to the committee. We are tape recording this, so for witnesses and others up at the front table, if you would introduce yourself and your name and who you represent, and then we'll know who's on the tape for future reference. And welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Dale Thompson. I'm the president and CEO of the Benedictine Health System, but have served as the chair of the Long-Term Care Advisory Commission. And it's really a pleasure to be here today to share with you some of the thoughts that we have as a commission. Hopefully they'll be helpful to you as you deliberate a lot, I think, of dimensions of how to best serve veterans going forward. It does feel a little lonely sitting here flying solo, but I see a lot of familiar faces who were a part of this entire effort for over 6 months. Many of them know far more than I do about the parts, if not all of this, and I would hope there's a way for you to entertain comments or questions from them later on. I think there's a wealth of information sitting in the gallery here that you could benefit from. I see a couple of familiar faces, Senator Erickson and Representative Severson, who didn't miss a meeting. Were also very helpful. I hope I didn't miss somebody in helping us shape our opinion. Oh, yes, Representative Murphy, indeed. You're blocked by this chair in front of me. This is earlier, Representative Murphy as well, who, although they were ex officio, provided great insight for us on the commission. We really appreciate their input. What I wanted to do today was provide a relatively brief overview of what I think are the most substantive parts of the commission's report, and then stand for questions, because I'm sure you have many of them. I think if there was a short version of this whole thing, it would be to say that our greatest contribution might be in the report in trying to articulate a broader vision than we may have had in the past about how to serve veterans effectively. That it's been a lot about buildings, been a lot about things that are important and will be important going forward, but that there seems to be a new way that baby boomers want to care for themselves, their parents, a lot that the state has learned about different ways to provide long-term care, and we discovered that that applies to veterans as well as to non-veterans. So there may be some fundamental rethinking of how we can best serve veterans and keep them healthy and independent and with choice and living close to their families and supporting them in ways that we may not have thought about in the past. And so we've tried to articulate that vision. That is a lot to get your arms around, and I think we feel our job now is to try to help clarify what we meant in some cases and to stick around a while to see if we can shed some light on what indeed we thought could happen with that vision. And I think the other piece of what might be the most valuable is the consensus we seem to reach at the end of this entire effort. And it came in the form of veterans themselves personally, individually commenting. It came in the form of families. It came in the form of veterans groups in particular, all of whom I think are represented here today and can speak for themselves. But to have them come together in the form of a letter of support at the end was pretty gratifying. It made us feel like we were on the right track, and I think you have a great launching pad here to look into the reality of what you can make happen going forward. I'll try to use some PowerPoint slides here that hopefully you can see. There are not 100 of them, there's just a few. And I'll try to hit the high points and then, Mr. Chairman, stand for questions, as I mentioned earlier. You probably have seen a copy of the report by now. It's a spiral-bound document, looks like this. It's also online. I think all of you have received a copy. If you haven't, the full report is this document. There's an executive summary in the report, and I'm going to try to see if I can't do the executive summary of the executive summary and give you some pretty concise points.
Excuse me, there were some copies. I know some of you have them. We are printing more copies. We underestimated the size of the audience. So for those that want a copy of the report, we will have one available here shortly, and you'll see them show up at the table in the front. So just thought I'd mention that.
Thanks, Murph.
The commission's history and charter, I think you're probably well aware of. It was created by the governor in large part, I believe, in response to the problems at the Minneapolis Veterans Home, which most of you are familiar with and we'll talk about a little later. The charge was in the form of an executive order, but essentially the charge was to provide recommendations to the governor on long-term care operations, administration, management, and governance models, which incorporate the best examples of innovative approaches to maximize the quality of care and quality of life for veterans. We were looking for a very succinct version of the charge. That's probably a good example. The commission had 7 members who volunteered for public service, if you will. Many of them with backgrounds in long-term care, related administrative experience, and I think there was clearly an effort to try to find folks who could contribute something from their life's work and from their experience to helping find the way forward. There were 8 ex officio members as well of the commission, and all of those individuals are listed in the report. The commission was chartered with a life of about 18 months to run through, I believe, July of next year. There are many of us who felt that work expands sometimes to fill the time allotted, and so we were more interested in kind of getting at the heart of it to see if we couldn't come up with some recommendations in a shorter period of time. And so we did meet 9 times from May 16th through November 19th. The group was very committed and dedicated to the process. I think if you, many of you were in the room at the first meeting when people answered the question as to why they volunteered for the duty they did, we told them if they did good, we would double their pay, which meant they could get 2 cups of coffee instead of 1 at the break. But all of them had some very personal stories about care of a parent, care of a spouse, veteran spouse, and other personal stories related to their belief that something extra should be done to thank those folks who stepped forward to serve our country in the way we all know that they've done in the past and they're doing today. And so it was with a very, I think, personal commitment on the part of each member of the commission that taken in total was a lot of people looking to come up with the right thing to do. And so if you take the time to review this, it's the best effort I think any group could make to come up with the answer, what's the right thing to do going forward. And embedded in the report, I think, are a lot of clues in that regard. The care at the Minneapolis Veterans Home, of course, has gotten a lot of press, and you've all read it and followed it, and not to lose sight of our task with this broader vision, we were charged with saying something intelligent about what should happen with that. And that was a plateful to get one's arms around, let alone tackle some of these bigger questions about the entire state and all 5 campuses. But to speak to this first, the report, I think, is rich with recommendations that we think would be helpful to address the problems with Minneapolis Home. There were many regulatory violations, 4 care outcomes fines leading to the formation of the commission. But the good news is that during the life of the commission, not totally, hopefully partly due, but mostly due to the work of others, during the life of the commission, we reached a point in November where there were no outstanding correction orders or deficiencies at the Minneapolis Veterans Home. And that, as they say in the old country, is a good thing. The commission's primary concern, though, was sustainability. It's one thing if you're familiar with nursing facilities and how they're regulated. There was a study recently done in the United States that looked for the most regulated industry in the country. It was a close first, second, and third between nuclear power, banking, and nursing homes. But nursing homes won, hands down. They won by the pound, they won by the page, they won by the line, per line in the Federal Register. And so it's indeed, nursing homes have been, over the years, very heavily regulated. And the Minneapolis Veterans Home, under somewhat of a different scenario, has been heavily regulated itself. And it's one thing to get a correction order and fix it, it's another thing to have it stay fixed. Because you can be in compliance and out of compliance and in compliance and out of compliance if you don't have solid systems of care, committed people who are interested in incremental improvement in quality over time, a good workforce who has high morale, gets along well, and is working hard to achieve the mission. No stronger mission could you ever find in long-term care than serving veterans. And so some of those fundamental things are broken things don't stay fixed very long, and our biggest concern was sustainability. So when you read the recommendations in the report about the Minneapolis home, hopefully they speak to the long term. and we looked very hard for best practice. We asked the question in 400-bed nursing facilities around the country when it runs like a fine-tuned watch, what's going on there? What can we learn from that? What's happening there that didn't happen here? And we had a lot of good testimony, a lot of good information from a lot of different people, and hopefully shed some light on that. Fundamental problems, there are no simple solutions. Leadership positions that had been unfilled for a lengthy period of time. Reliable care delivery systems, the passing of medications, nursing practice, those things that can be strengthened and systems that can be put into a long-term care facility that will sustain performance and good care outcomes for the long term. We found some of those. We had people testify about those. And I'm happy to say I think that the Minneapolis home is about the business of implementing those now to attain the sustainability. A lack of positive work environment is being addressed, I think, by some of the leadership positions that are now being filled. If you were to go through the recommendations about the Minneapolis Veterans Home, you will see several pages with detail, especially in the long version of the report. This would be the laundry list of the things that we spoke to. Development of a strong leadership team, physician leadership and medical direction, to get clinical care right is to have a strong team of nursing staff at the facility, but also physician leadership. And we spoke to the need for full-time medical direction at the facility, for example. Partnerships with the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. We found in our efforts to talk with the leadership and the CEO of the VA Medical Center and others, real interest in partnering with the Minnesota Veterans Homes in general, but that the two had never really met in the night the way they probably should have to create the kind of acute care leadership that can come from and rehabilitative leadership that can come from a place like the Minneapolis Veterans or the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. The same we believe would be true with St. Cloud and Sioux Falls and Fargo and others that overlap into the service area. We think that's rich with opportunity. Provision of primary care services to physicians or to patients and residents, how veterans in the VA homes, when they see physicians, what impact a primary care physician has on their care. We think there's some opportunity there to improve care for veterans. Establishment of a quality management, quality improvement system. If you were to go out and look at the best of the best long-term care facilities, once upon a time there were 450 nursing facilities in Minnesota, today there are 390. 60 of them have locked the key and thrown it away, and for the most part, many of them gone bankrupt, but that's another story. But if you look at the best of the best, you will see places where these clinical systems are very strong, where there is a movement to another level beyond just regulatory compliance, to a level where quality of care and quality of life are really achieving a level of excellence. And as I mentioned earlier, we tried to steal from where we could find those best ideas. We took testimony and tried to make recommendations that hopefully can be a template for the Minneapolis home to follow. Clinical leadership, ongoing training, development of staff and clinical teams, implementation of clinical software, medical record system. Seems like kind of a boring topic, but a fundamental cornerstone to getting care right day to day, month to month. And then a culture that supports continuous quality improvement. Nothing beats leadership, nothing beats culture, a culture committed to quality to make a difference. And without it, you have nothing. With it, you have everything, and you can harness a group of people and long-term care professionals at the bedside of some of the most committed people in healthcare, and you can tap that resources in some extraordinary ways if you can create that culture. So there is no easy fix. We try to speak directly to these. We're encouraged by the new leadership being put into place and what we've seen happen at the Minneapolis Veterans Home. Others can speak more directly to it, but we were pleased that they did get back into compliance and are on the way to sustainability. As I mentioned earlier, the recommendations are derived from best practice. If the Minneapolis Veterans Home were to use this template, they can reach far back into the individuals that testified, the organizations that provided information. And we suggested that they may be a little more outward looking and be able to partner, because this could indeed be a place of excellence if it were to link up with other parts of the long-term care delivery system and share in what they know. We also recommended that there be a transparent, in this case, kind of customized transition plan to ensure accountability to all stakeholders. Many of you know this, an nursing home gets in trouble with the health department, a lot of bad things can happen. In this case, it went to the point of agreement, stipulation letters, the health department stipulating that certain things would happen. With the shift of responsibility to the Department of Veterans Affairs, technically speaking, the string of bad things gets short-circuited and starts over. And our suggestion was that may be nice so that you don't have lots of surveyors in your building every day, but there still is accountability here. There's accountability to you as the legislature, accountability to the public, and to volunteer to be transparent about the progress being made, to make it easy for you to see the progress being made. This we thought was an important recommendation because everybody is committed to the same task here, which is to improve care. And so voluntary process in partnership with the health department to sort of check on how we're doing is one recommendation we made. Moving on quickly, two other areas of relatively heavy lifting were in the area of governance and leadership. And you probably know by now that the commission recommended transfer the Veterans Home Program to the Department of Veterans Affairs. And some of you have been part of the legislature for quite a while, you'll say, deja vu all over again, because at one point in time this was part of the Department of Veterans Affairs. We knew that. We heard a lot of testimony about that. I think what we learned was that today's Department of Veterans Affairs is not your father's Oldsmobile. It's not the same Department of Veterans Affairs that we saw a picture of back when this was a different way. The number of programs and services for veterans today are much greater. To have those aligned in one department of Veterans Affairs and have Veterans Long-Term Care out in left field, if you will, with a different structure and not have the ability to align, we thought was fundamentally flawed. And especially if you believe that the right thing to do going forward is to create a continuum of care that isn't just about a nursing home bed, which is today relatively a last choice, not a first choice, certainly not an only choice, then all of that continuum of care, helping people stay at home, helping people live in an apartment with services, turns on the ability to take a lot of services and support for veterans and harness them together and align them to put a package together so somebody is able to have the resources and support they need, for example, to stay in their own home. So it made sense to us, even though it was that way before, to try it again in a different way and to have all of this in one place with the opportunity, if we can figure out the rest of your heavy lifting, to align those services and support to provide that full continuum of care as we do for all non-veterans in the state of Minnesota, happen with care for veterans. The restructure of the DVA is outlined in here and graphically so, and the commissioners here could speak, I think, much more directly to this. But it envisions two deputy commissioners, one for veteran services and one for veteran health care. There was an effort to emphasize the need to clarify and communicate the chain of command. The revised DVA's mission, so that it clearly states it's about post-acute and long-term care. To establish and statute a new veteran health board. Indeed, this board is advisory, but rather than get worried about whether it's advisory or real, I think the substantive need here is for vision, for setting a strategic plan in place, for bringing expertise to this board that can shed light on these pieces that need to get put in place. We believe that if you ask the right people, they would show up and contribute to this effort going forward, advisory or not. And establish the formal interagency agreements between the DVA and partnering agencies, including the Department of Human Services, Health, Housing Finance, and the Board on Aging. This relates directly to trying to recreate a full continuum of care. If you were to go out and look at long-term care campuses that serve other than veterans, many times you find a shrinking nursing home who's taking care of a larger number of people for a shorter period of time on their way home. And you'd find assisted living options, and you'd find housing options with services, and you'd find a care coordination piece and you'd find an array of services, a campus, a regional place where people can go to find the support they need. To pull that off going forward for veterans, we felt a lot of state agencies would really need to work together. Minnesota Housing Finance, for example, in our view, could be a part of creating housing options on these campuses. Board on Aging does a lot of great work looking at the broader needs of older Americans or older Minnesotans. And Human Services and others have great experience. Many of you have heard of something called the MSHO program, which for non-veterans and veterans, if they choose, can take Medicare benefits and other benefits, put them together, assign a lead person to help a family figure out how to help an older parent or spouse be able to stay at home. You created that over 15 years. It's one of the best examples in the country. There are only about five or six like it. If you look closely at it, you could come up with a veteran's version of that, we feel. And in a separate program with additional emphasis, it captured a lot of the creative work that's been done in that regard. And so we envision some of that happening as part of the governance structure and the working together of different agencies. On the leadership side, there was an issue early on with compensation, although I don't think that's the biggest hurdle if you look at how long-term care leaders are compensated in the private, for-profit, not-for-profit sectors. There's a slight difference, but it was worth noting. But something we believe could be overcome. To fill the vacant leadership positions, the administrator at the Minneapolis home and the executive director now with Gail Acevedo, who's here someplace, who's taking over, we feel really good about the initiative happening to find strong leaders to fill those positions. Establish a strong leadership team in Minneapolis is very imperative, and I know that the staff is about the business of trying to make that happen. We found a lot of good people at Minneapolis providing care at the bedside, some of them looking for direction and looking to come together and create that culture. And so I think leadership rose to the top of saying that's something we need to get at. To organize the five veterans facilities in a central office around a small multi-facility model, that may be something that maybe hard to understand, but if you were to ask, where are there five long-term care facilities among the 17,000 in the country that cluster up in groups of two or three or four or five? There are many that do. They're called small multi-facility organizations. If you look at the best of the best and say, how are they organized? They do have, at the central office level, if you will, a cadre of people who help share expertise, find economies of scale, draw out quality. They draw out information systems, they draw out good HR practices to hire and retain good people so that each of the five facilities don't have to reinvent the wheel and do that. They spend somewhere between 3% and 5% of the total resources going to all the facilities. The central office cult function now spends about 2% of the VA central office, if you will, or the Veterans Home central office. And so there's a model already in place that's close to the way some of the best groups of facilities are managed, and we thought best practice would be to encourage a look at those small multi-facility models and tweak the structure of the Minnesota Veterans Homes now, and that I think could provide a lot of additional support to help unleash the creative efforts of the people at the bedside in all five communities. The Commissioner of DVA, the Deputy Commissioner, and the Health Board will have their hands full. They need to create a vision. They need to make that vision clear. They need to make it compelling so that all of the other constituencies that come into play to make anything happen can see the vision, can displace the status, it can understand that there's a continuum of care at the heart of this thing. It's veterans that we need to serve. And there's 150,000 veterans over age 65 in Minnesota, out of 400,000. Well, veterans are under 65, but there's 150,000 over 65, on any given day, only 600 of them are getting care in the Minnesota Veterans Home. Out of the 800 plus that are there, 25% of people in Minnesota Veterans Home are under 65. They have other issues. They have issues, mental health issues, disability issues, the topic for this afternoon. So of that 150,000 serving only 600, when on any given day you can expect that between 8 and 10,000 of those 150,000 over 65 are getting some form of long-term care. but they're not getting it for the Minnesota Veterans Program. What's to be made of that? And we think the answer to that is we're not casting a wide enough net. The $70 million we're spending could be spent differently. Could be spent less on nursing home beds and more on a continuum of care. That's what's happened in Minnesota with nursing home spending in general. Nursing home spending in Minnesota is 30% of the Medicaid budget, which a recent Kaiser study says is now some of the lowest in the country. That doesn't mean it's bad. It means that you've created a policy shift to provide other options for older persons in Minnesota to stay healthy and independent in their own home. And I think there's a strong parallel we should draw between the two and say, how can we spend $70 million extra and not create that possession? And I think a lot of commission members felt we should step back, try to get that vision, and do what's right going forward to try to move in a different direction. None of which can be done overnight. It's a long haul. It only took 10, 12, 15 years for you to do this in the non-veteran sector, but we can get started. But we can't get started unless we have a crisp vision that everybody can rally around and make sense. Mr. Chairman, I'll be quick and get to the end of this. Well, then we come to the heavy lifting. So what is this broader vision going forward? And I think the best way I would suggest, and it seems to work, is to try to put a human face on this. If you have had someone in your family, veteran or otherwise, if you've had to arrange care for, long-term care for, a parent, a grandparent, a spouse. If you thought about it for yourself, some of us just had our 60th birthday and you start thinking about this more than you would otherwise, but there are certain expectations about how to do this right when the time comes and you need some help. And the more you can put a human face on this, the more I think you can keep your eye on the target. What's the right thing to do? Is it to build something? Is it not to build something? Is it to create a program? Is it to find support? Is it to bring resources to bear so I can stay home longer? Get at the conviction that my vision of long-term care is somebody to get me down to the dock, out in the boat, catch some walleyes, and get back, put me by the campfire with a good bottle of wine, and that's about it in terms of long-term care that I need. And we all have a vision of what the right thing to do is. Well, this broader vision, as I mentioned earlier, we think is the heart of what to do going forward for 3, 5, 10, and 15 years. There's no reason why Minnesota, as the chairman said earlier, can't apply what it has become in the country as an innovator in long-term care delivery across the continuum to a better way to care for veterans. Your new executive director has had experience with that in California. It's helped create some of that. And we think you've got the beginnings here of leadership to do that going forward. But what would you see in the 5 campuses that are out there that would be different? We believe you could see regional centers that would meet the needs of older and younger veterans. We only had a little time to understand the needs of younger veterans, but it is extraordinary. Colonel Ralph Morris shared with us, you know, his weekends at Camp Ripley, where he and a team of others would interview every veteran coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And if it isn't prosthetics and rehab, it's families that disintegrated while they're gone, people married just before they left, coming home to no family, all kinds of other post-traumatic stress issues. Goodness knows what the tip of the iceberg looks like, but these 5 regional campuses could be places where veterans, younger and older, could go to receive help and support. For a younger veteran, it might be an extension of the VA medical centers, and they're excellent in rehab that could be brought to bear in a post-acute long-term care setting. Long-term care facilities are pretty good places to do PT, OT, and rehab. Sometimes they know more about it because of their long-term care nature than acute care. My acute care friends aren't here, so I can say that. But they become very good places when supported by professionals from places like the VA Medical Center to be very integral to helping rehab work over the long run. Professional care coordination and planning sounds trite, but that's what the MSHO piece is about that you created. We think that could exist on these five campuses. If you went to these five campuses, you could see housing options if you wanted to. You could see assisted living suites. Wouldn't have to be two people in an old nursing home room with four people sharing a bathroom. It doesn't have to be that way. We can shrink the size of one component and create the other. Alternatives to institutional care and new housing with service options. Excellence in chronic disease management, nursing, and rehabilitative care. The VA medical centers are particularly good at Alzheimer's, care management. They're good at disease management, be it diabetes management or other types of care over the long term. People living longer, baby boomers living longer, veterans living longer, we're going to have a need to manage chronic disease over the long term. And these campuses, we believe, could be recast both in how they look in terms of bricks and mortar and what goes on there. And that will be your challenge. It's easy to build stuff, not so easy to figure out programs. I think there's a dose of both needed, but nothing that may look like the past. And so to really have this vision articulated in a way that you as policymakers can figure out what to do to enable it clearly becomes a question. I would probably suggest, somebody asked during the process, why isn't this commission asking for a whole bunch of money? Having been around this place a lot, would be an opportunity to do that, and I'm not so sure that additional resources are needed, but two things come through in the report. One is that it isn't money that is at the fundamental problem of the care issues at the Minneapolis home. Everyone pretty well agreed to that. It's something else. So money was not the issue there. When it comes to implementing this vision, there are some resources that would be needed to do some solid strategic planning to lay out how one implements this vision over time. Undoubtedly, there's resources that would be needed to shrink the size of bricks and mortar around things like nursing home beds and to expand the bricks and mortar around some other types of services. And so, indeed, there's probably a need for resources, but it doesn't rise to the forefront at this point because, frankly, we didn't know enough about what it would take to transform these campuses. There's plenty of examples to look at, but the trick is to catch the vision first, agree that that's the way to take care of veterans in a better way going forward, then get on about the business of trying to figure out how much all that would cost. Finally, concluding comments that I would make and then stand for questions. Minnesota has, as the chairman mentioned, been recognized as a national leader in developing creative long-term care for non-veterans. It goes without saying. There are many examples, and you could look at those examples to see where the best of the best is and apply it to a better system of long-term care for veterans. I believe there's strong support for this transformation. I think it grew as many of the people in this room never missed a single commission meeting. In between time, they went back, particularly some of the veterans groups went back to some working groups they have. And I was struck by the substance of knowledge that some of these veterans groups pick on the Legion, but they have a rehab group. The chair, Randy, is here. There's a group that has a working knowledge about rehabilitative care and a working knowledge about the continuum sensitivity applied to veterans, and many of the others do clearly as well. And so I sense support for capturing this vision and putting the time in to get that right, because it should be a better way to serve veterans, and I think that's worth a lot as long as we're all in a search for the right thing to do here. The transition must result in a care system that meets the changing needs of veterans, including younger veterans, which frankly we don't have the answer for, only to know that it is a big issue that you can't skip over if you're going to design a system of care for all veterans going forward. Finally, we suggested that the governor needs to provide leadership. Much of this was implemented by executive order, some of the structural pieces. And then the legislature has a huge task, which is to try to understand this new vision and figure out how you begin. Not, as I mentioned earlier, something can be done in 1 year or two or even three, but beyond. But how do you begin to shape the vision and make the right initial commitment to go down a trail that takes us to this broader a view of how we serve veterans going forward. I think I'm at the end. Yeah, so I'll stop there and see if anybody has questions. Or
well, thank you, Mr. Thompson. This is a very positive report, and I think it's recognized that way by us, and also I hope with the groups that were so involved putting this together. obviously you're right, we've had a number of years of kind of upheaval, and I think this report really goes a long ways to giving us some direction, some guidance, but giving us some positive feedback on veterans in this state and services that and a vision that may be forthcoming. I've got some questions, Senator Vickerman does, and certainly I failed to mention, but I know Representative Murphy Severson and I think Erickson Rolfe, along with Senator Day, were a part of this task force, and certainly if you have any additional comments, we want to allow that at this time too. But Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Thompson, I picked up when you said we have for out in Greater Minnesota, I'm going to talk about that. Every one of my counties has got a brand new hospital, and every one of them has a rehab center, and every nursing home has a rehab center. So I like the idea of letting them stay at home in a rural setting, go to this hospital or the nursing home and get the rehab they need and then stay there rather than come up here in this place they're scared to death to drive up here in the first place. I'll go to that one. That's my first question. My second question is there's a waiting list of 500. You know, we discharge more than that every day. So I'm trying to figure out how we can possibly take care of them. We can, but we can't have them all at the VA hospitals because I think Laverne, I think, is full. There isn't a lot of room within those hospitals. So we got to look at a different way to do it. I think you got some positive ideas here. As far as the nursing home in Minneapolis, it saddens me to think that what it had to go through.
Yeah.
Because I always looked at Minnesota as being number one. And when the rest of the states looked at what the VA hospital in Minneapolis, all they did was shake their head, there's something wrong here. So I hope that we can get that straightened out, get that back where it should be, the star.
Yeah. Just a couple of quick comments in response. The family, the newly formed family council is here today in force from the Minneapolis Veterans Home, and they are something. They've had a couple of evening meetings, and they are committed to be a partner in trying to get things right for the long haul. And they know of what they speak because they have loved ones who received care for a week or 2 years or 10 years in the case of some. So you have some fundamental change going on there in terms of people coming together that I think is positive. Some family members will point out to you that it's really nice that you provide a little support and now everybody's going to get to stay at home. But some spouses will tell you, and to the detriment of their own health sometimes and otherwise, you reach a point where you can't do it at home. And so that's where you get back to the campuses themselves serve a purpose of having this array of services. On the rehab side, I don't think there is a better opportunity to do good rehab in a long-term care campus than exists for these campuses if they can connect with the VA medical centers, because the VA medical centers are known nationally for the work they do, particularly in the rehab area. Some of us in the private sector would love to have that ability to partner with the acute care sector. So that is a missed opportunity if those folks can't come together and at Laverne or Fergus Falls or wherever it might be. And, to say that the veteran, here's the thing, you should go to Minneapolis and be 200 miles away from your family and this is a good deal for you to go to the nursing home there. It didn't work for my dad, who ended up getting care in his own community. And we think it's on track. But it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's having the ability to meet the needs of people in whatever state they're in. It's not... It would be nice if it was just a cookie cutter. It used to be. A nursing home bed was the only thing there was. And if you couldn't stay at home, that's right. But we're smarter than that now. And we know that we can do things better and differently. So we're hopeful that could be applied. It's kind of a long answer to a great short question.
And I think the challenge is also, and I'd like the committees to start thinking this coming year about how we're delivering these services regionally. Geographically speaking, we talk about Minneapolis a lot. But everyone that's in Minneapolis isn't from Minneapolis. Representative Dominguez, I know there's Minneapolis is important, but they come from all over the Twin Cities and even outstate to the Minneapolis facility. So we need to think about how we might deliver those services better regionally in the metro area, to folks, as well as outstate. We keep talking about the existing campuses, but that represents SCOI. I know there's not a lot campus-wise up in your area of the state. And so how do we deliver services geographically around the state if you're not, you know, within 50 miles of a Laverne or a Fergus Falls? So I think that's one of our challenges, too. How do you establish adult daycares or in-home service teams or other things that can be utilized as a different type of approach to the actual on-campus type care that we're viewing right now? So I think that's one of the challenges I think we're going to talk about this session and hopefully start laying out some groundwork for, along with the Department of Veterans Affairs. Anyone on the board have any comments? I want to open it up to you first. Erickson, Ropes, Murphy, Severson. Representative Severson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just, it was truly an honor to be able to serve on this panel here. I wasn't able to make every meeting, but I think it was, in the meetings that I was in, it was a real blessing to see the talent that had accumulated around the table there. People who were not getting their salary doubled or even tripled. I mean, they were doing this because they loved veterans and they understood the importance of the mission, and they brought some tremendous talent to the table in terms of expanding the vision on what were the requirements, what were the future needs for our veterans to better serve them. And I just wanted to say a personal thanks to each one of them who took the time, and it was out of their own private time to meet sometimes a demanding schedule. And I do so much appreciate Mr. Thompson's expertise in this process. He was a tremendous leader and really kept us on task and brought about a tremendous package here, as well as the veteran organizations that stepped up to the table and really voiced their opinion and voiced their desire on seeing this process develop. And I think it was just a tremendous joint effort, and I really was honored to be a part of that process. Thank you.
Very good. Senator Erickson Rowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Co-Chair. Thank you, Mr. Thompson. I've heard this presentation now several times, also being on the Health Care Committee and then on the Advisory Commission itself. Mr. Thompson did an excellent job, I think, of touching all the major points, but I just want to underscore a couple. This is about the broader vision. This is about moving into the 21st century for health care for veterans, and I'm very excited about that. I think the public sector is already moving that direction. We do want to offer our veterans more. We want high-quality care, and we want to give them more opportunities instead of just staying at home to the point where they need really tertiary kind of care in a nursing home, that we do bring them a lot of different options along the way, which is what we're trying to do through a public policy for the rest of the citizens of the state. One of the things I really believe in that I saw happen during this process was the whole consensus building, teamwork approach to problem solving. I think we could use this model in the legislature as we continue to work together over the next session and many years. We need to come together. I think veterans issues are a really good way for us to do that. This is not about being a Republican. It's not about being an independent or being a Democrat. It's about taking care of our veterans and taking care of our veterans' families and listening to those people. And what I saw happen in the process of this committee work was that people put politics aside, and we really tried to find the best solutions. We also looked at public and private sector approaches to the same problem. And I think this is one of the things that I really value, and that is that people need to come together, work together, build a consensus, and we may not have something that everyone is absolutely 100% on, but it is a really good product, and it's not one that's way over here, and it's not one that's way over here. And it's going to work across the state, and I agree with Representative Junkie's opening statement about Minnesota can be a model in so many ways. We have a great state. We can really move forward, and I think this process is a way to do that. I'm really exceptionally pleased that the committee decided to move to a place where they're going to be valuing and listening to the input of patients in the evaluating the quality of what's going on and coming up with some solution, as well as the family members and the staff. Because if you don't listen to everyone who's involved with the problem, you're going to forget or overlook a segment. And the other major point that Mr. Thompson made is, besides the broader vision, is the consensus project or process itself. And he said this many times, and when I was on the school board and, you know, struggling with all sorts of volatile school issues, you know, I said many times too, it's always about relationships. Your bottom line, your foundation building block has to be a good relationship where we can trust each other. We can come up with the most beautiful plan from the top down, and if the people on the ground who are implementing the process don't trust you, or we don't trust each other across the table, this beautiful plan is not going to work. So I heard a lot of discussion in this group talking about building the relationship with families, and we heard the family council's up and running now. We need to listen to what the families need, what their experiences are, what the patients need, and then the staff as well. Because if it's just an administrative solution, if it's just a legislative solution, it's not going to work. So we need to lateralize decision-making, and then we can all move forward together. So I'm just really pleased.
Thank you. You have anything? You don't have to talk, but I want to offer it to you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will just say, one, thanks to the vets, who without the vets group, this report wouldn't be here today. And then I'll just close by saying I look forward to working with members of this committee and members of the legislature to begin to bring the report into reality.
Thank you for your work. Mr. Thompson, you talked about the Veterans Healthcare Board recommending putting that together. Did your report recommend membership of that board?
Mr. Chairman, yes it did. I'm looking at my notes trying to figure out where it is. If you have the full report, I think it's on page 41. That might be the membership of the commission. Brian, do you know where it is? 28?
No,
it's
not.
Page 28. Page 28, thank you.
Okay.
And it establishes, I think, it envisions a board of 9 members appointed, I believe, by the governor on page 27. On page 28, it speaks to the types of expertise.
Okay.
Oh, did, yeah.
One of the suggestions I'd have, and I know the commissioner's on his way up here shortly, but following up on what Erickson Rope said, if you really want to have ownership and buy-in by everyone, I would suggest a couple ex officio members from the legislature on there also. Otherwise, the legislature doesn't seem to take ownership. And I know I've only been here a dozen years, but it seems to me boards that go off and work on their own and then try and come in during a legislative session and present. Not that we don't listen and consider, but it's a lot easier if we've got a couple members of the committee that maybe sat on that board and they're bringing it with them to the committee they sit on, and it makes things a lot easier. So I'm throwing out some suggestions there, Commissioner, as we think through establishing some of this over the next year and what works with that. So I appreciate that. Any other questions for Mr. Thompson? No, Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members and Mr. Thompson, for this report. As I was scanning through the report, and I think you made mention also, but what I have concern of is what I heard last session from the veterans themselves and veterans that haven't been served. And that's the portion of outreach to the veterans. What mechanism are we going to use to get those veterans so we can have a good plan here in the state of Minnesota? Are you going to need more staff to do the outreach? Resources to the, you know, more media? What's the process that we're going to use?
Mr. Thompson, any suggestions? Otherwise, we will hit that when the commissioner gets up here, too.
we tackled that question. You can see issues now nationwide about veterans not getting the benefits that they're otherwise entitled to, and it's a broad topic. Why are there 600 veterans that turn to the Minnesota Veterans Homes in Minnesota, and then the other 10,000 are with their feet trying to go somewhere else? I think awareness is one thing, but if this vision of a campus, particularly with the ability to coordinate a plan of care, if you will, to support a veteran in whatever setting that they choose to be their setting of choice. If that was real, if it was good, substantive, actually worked, you might see more people served because, I mean, we found that when all else fails now for veterans, a lot of times the veterans, county veteran service offices are an interesting crowd. When all else fails, it gets to their doorstep, and we heard testimony from several who figured it out. They just figured it out. It's not a very formal way, but they've learned where the resources are and they put it together. Now, in a more formal way, like the Minnesota Mentor Program, if you apply that to the veterans service delivery that we envision, if each of these campuses were better able to do, to offer that and to get good at it, just because it's the best place to go may change something. But right now, it doesn't have that. There's a lot of good work being done in these cases, but it's domiciliary care, it's nursing home care, and boy, there's a lot of walls to break down. I mean, there's some folks here that know far more about this than I do. When, you know, the federal government says use domiciliary care as this, don't try to make it modern assisted living. There are rules for this and rules for that. You can take money and spend it on this, but you can't spend it on that. The harder we push, the more we could not find hard statutes that said you can't do it as much as current practice. Maybe easy enough for us to say, but we suggest that you push pretty hard on why can't you, and try to break down the barriers that would allow it all to come together. That will not be a simple task. And if you, the best model to look at is what it took for the last 10 or 15 years to change it for non-veterans in Minnesota. You have leaders in this legislature who have spent years helping shape that. And many of them could tell you what a struggle that was. But here we are today, where 30% of Medicaid is spent on the nursing home bed, 70% is spent on a different way, and that's a huge change from where we were. So we didn't have a magic wand, but we think since it was done once, it could be done again and better for veterans.
Representative Doty and Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Thompson, first of all, I want to commend you and your commission. It looks like you started from the needs of the veterans and worked your way up, and that's we don't see that often enough. Thank you. My question is, in my district, there are a couple of residences, assisted living residences. One is privately owned, one is a nonprofit, who only bring in veterans into their residences. To what extent is your commission looking forward working with those types of organizations outside of the regular VA?
Mr. Tom?
Chairman, Representative, that would be an important topic to look into. The private assisted living, private informal long-term care system, both for-profit and non-profit, I would argue is very interested in serving veterans. For years there was the veterans nursing home contract, other kinds of ways where veterans had benefits and then could shop in their community to receive certain benefits, short of going to one of the veterans' homes. There is a big debate about, you know, whether that informal system should be part of serving veterans more or less, whether we should invest in the campuses. But to the extent that there was some portability with benefits, veterans would have more options. I think there are providers who would like to do that. But fewer and fewer of them, it seems like what we found, are doing it because it's hard to connect the resources that veterans have to the private facility. But it's worth exploring. We found a whole, and there's this whole section in the report about how one takes the veteran's benefit and the private contribution that veteran families are supposed to make based on their income level. That is quite a maze, actually. There are some here who know that chapter and verse. There's some families here that can tell you stories about what it was like to figure that out. We met families who tried to figure it out, gave up, and went a different route. So the interplay between the private sector, if you will, and the established veteran long-term care delivery systems is a place to be explored. Because if there are 150,000 veterans over 65, if 10,000 on any given day are getting some form of long-term care, for us to get from 600 to 10,000 within the formal VA system will take a while, if nothing else. That's an important area for you to ask about, I think. Look at, to ask some folks from both sides how they feel about that. I don't know if that's helpful or not, but that's an issue. Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Thompson. And, you know, to address your question a little bit, Representative Dominguez, on the outreach piece, maybe you remember last year we did include some outreach dollars to our county veteran service officers for outreach in the local counties. I represent seven entire counties in the western part of the state, and so I've had the opportunity to see how those dollars are being used in some of the counties anyway, and I think they're doing some very effective forms of outreach to help get some information out on what kinds of services are available to the veterans. And they had if you throw a free dinner for the veterans, you know, you get several hundred people show up, most of whom have never been into their veteran service office at the county level. And so, you know, it gives you a contact with them that they haven't had up to that point. And I think, you know, there are a number of creative things going on out there that I think do some of that outreach that you talked about, Mr. Thompson, and the Representative Dominguez was inquiring about as well. So, you know, I realize we didn't give them a lot of money, but they got a few thousand dollars a piece, and I think there are some things happening with it. So I guess I'd just like to report that.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you again, Ms. Thompson, for the work here. And this may be beyond the purview, but following up on Chair Junkie's observation, county veteran service officers in my area are coming to me concerned about higher transportation costs, getting veterans to care facilities, given the five located around the state. This may have been beyond your commission's report, but do you have advice for us on how we might address this concern, the higher transportation costs? In fact, we're now starting to charge veterans for part of the drive up to the cities to get care.
Mr. Thompson, Mr. Chairman, Representative, that transportation is a key issue to having any kind of full continuum work. There's no doubt about that, and we heard that. These veteran service officers are pretty creative. They can get volunteer veterans to drive. They do lots of things to piece that all together. But that component would have to be addressed as part of this vision, because there's geography here, big geography, around some of the outstate campuses. So unless you solve that part, you haven't really put the grease to making all these services actually happen. And so I think that is a key issue. Thank you. Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much. We're going to move now. Commissioner, you and Deputy, come on down, or whoever you're bringing with you. To the commissioner and to the members and to the audience, I think one of the keys of this report certainly is oversight and governance. Issues were discussed by the committee very intensely, and obviously the decision was made to sign an executive order, which you have in your files. I take that as a good thing. I think the first thing we need to say is thank you to Jeff Johnson and the board, the former board. I don't think that this document is in any way, shape, or form a reflection on their hard work over many years. I want to say that publicly, and I think everyone in the room would repeat that we had an outstanding board working, but I think modeling came into play, and we decided there was maybe a better model. And members, one of the things I think that disturbed legislators particularly was when situations did arise, whether it's Minneapolis or anywhere else in the state concerning a veteran's home board, we really didn't have anyone to call into the room and say, what's going on? It's we need answers from you. The governor appointed the board members, but then really was separate. There was it didn't fall into a commissioner level oversight so that you could point to the governor's office or the commissioner's office or the legislative committees
that finance and oversee policy at these places. And I think that was an important missing element. And that's one of the main reasons that this correction, I think, has been made, to provide some oversight and certainly assign some responsibility. When things do go awry, we have a place to go. And we have a place to ask questions and hopefully discover what answers are. So that new place to go on behalf of the governor now is the commissioner, Dyrud. And I will let you certainly introduce yourself and whoever else you want to discuss with you at the table. I see the new deputy. And we've got about a half hour till we want to adjourn for lunch. So I think there's some, again, I'm going to lay the groundwork, and you don't have to talk about all this, but obviously the things we're interested in, I think, from the commissioner's level, again, advisory board we talked about, I think you might want to hit on, there's probably some things statutorily we're going to have to do to facilitate this executive order and this transition. We want to start learning, not in detail, but some of your thoughts on that. As we progress, we also want to understand budgets. We've just combined two budgets. I would assume there's some synergies that will be cost-saving-wise. But also, we want to understand where there may be more needs for additional resources, which certainly we will talk about legislatively and hopefully appropriate where necessary. And then certainly, eventually down the road, we're going to talk about facilities around the state, both in the Twin Cities and outstate, and how we can enhance and better those, but also how we can put together a plan for the next 10 or 15 or 20 years down the line on where we want to be with facilities. So, Commissioner, with that, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed in any manner you deem fit.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Clark Dyrud. I'm Commissioner for Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. And let me introduce our Deputy Commissioner for Health Care, Gil Acevedo. And he will be talking later. He has had, this is, I think, the beginning of week two for him here from Chula Vista. But more on that as we proceed. I think you have nailed a very important highlight that that makes me, I don't know if it should be happy or uncomfortable. If things go awry, you have one person to come to, and that is me. That is the case. The executive order of November 19th took place, and I am well aware of history, as are many of you, and in fact I brought my first veteran to the Minneapolis Veterans Home in 1973 as a county service officer before, that was 2 years before the veterans homes were under the department the first time. So that's where my history goes. Anyway, I am here. I was wondering about this as the commission moved forward, and I would just like to begin by saying I have never been more optimistic in my life regarding the veterans' home. I just want to start from there, and then I want to move back. There are a couple ways to discuss this. One is about very directly the issues at Minneapolis, because those have been outlined. Those are very much part of everything. And then the broader picture of the vision for the future. So I want to say that I have been ex officio member of the Vets Homes Board. I was also ex officio member of the Long-Term Care Commission. And as ex officio, you keep your eyes and your ears open, and then you try to speak only when spoken to. So I have been observing and watching all of this. And and I would like to begin by going refreshing your memory to talk about Minneapolis first. There are I think it was the second or third slide of Chairman Thompson's slide that lists the fundamental problem at Minneapolis. But I would like to back. I just mentioned Chair Thompson. I guess as an overview, I would like to thank him in particular and the six other commission members for the work they did. And I think it's been alluded to by Representative Murphy, who just stepped out, but Senator Erickson, Ropes, and Representative Severson have all alluded to that. This committee, there's only one person who had any knowledge of the veterans field out of this group of 7, and they rolled up their sleeves, and they started officially meeting last May. And the thing that, again, watching and listening from the side, the thing that amazed me is that they immediately started with the vision. And that, as the month proceeded, I think it really is a way to proceed, and was very excellent, because they started with vision and then doubled back and started filling in the pieces. So that is the way I've tucked into my head for future operation. I think it's very effective to keep the eye on the prize. And I want to thank them for all their hard work, and thank the people that were ex-official and did roll up their sleeves and work. So, back to Minneapolis, one of the things that was asked was to address the issues of Minneapolis. And one thing that came in early, I remember, in fact, it was one of the first meetings, one of the first reports that I believe was from the Department of Health, that very specifically says that the size is not the issue. Some people said that Minneapolis is too large. And there are many organizations that are larger than Minneapolis that work quite well. So it is not just a matter of size. And that, as things went forward, there's a very excellent summary. It's leadership and reliable system. And what I wanted, that really encapsulates it. And I want to just define very briefly what we're talking about leadership regarding the Minneapolis Veterans Home or nursing home. When you're talking about leadership, you're not talking necessarily about an administrator. You're talking about how do you get a policy for, you know, delivery of meds. How do you get this policy to the individuals working the night shift on the third floor, for example? I mean, how do you take this and get it to the people? That is what we're talking about, leadership. And that was what was dismantled prior to 2005, which, again, without rehashing a lot of history, was very evident that had been dismantled. When that gets dismantled, the system breaks down. And since 2005, the process has been initiated to put back the leadership to get systems in place. And so an important part of the executive order was to act as if we were still under the stipulation from Department of Health. Department of Health had a stipulation in place to come in and not only do a baseline report of the Minneapolis Veterans Home, but then to continue monitoring. And so in November, that was made part of the executive order, that we would honor that as if it was still in place. So that is ongoing, and again, I'm extremely positive. The people who work at Minneapolis are as fine as anywhere else. I mean, that is again, real evidence. And I have visited in my short time, I have visited out there several times. I've visited with the family council, et cetera. So I am extremely optimistic that there is a, that we are moving towards reestablishing the leadership that then the systems follow that. And this is something that our deputy commissioner is, he's been doing this, you know, like right up his alley, and try to move on so that he can say a few words here also. So I think Minneapolis specifically is, and I think Chairman Thompson refers to it as heavy lifting. We're in that heavy lifting phase. But I am very, very optimistic. Now, moving on.
Before you do, Senator Kubley has a question.
Senator Kubley.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Dyrud, I guess. Just piggybacking on some of the outreach conversation we had with Mr. Thompson. You know, there was that appropriation in last year's bill that took the money out of the support our troops license plate thing. I guess I'm just curious, you know, part of that was for outreach, and since it was for outreach, I'm just wondering, have there been any applications to the department for that
for that funding that helps them to extend kind of beyond the limited amount that we were able to give them for the same purpose.
Well, Chair Durkee, Senator Kubley, I would welcome a chance to talk about outreach. We have you, the Senate, the House were very kind, and that we are. I would like to give a report on that. And I was asked today to limit it to the veteran's home. I'm real excited about some of the things we have done. We have present here our Deputy Commissioner Pugliese in the corner, and we have our legislative people here. And referring to what Representative Dominguez's comment earlier, you know, the outreach is such an important part of this. And we are really moving on that, and I would like to talk about that at maybe in front of your committees, I can get people up.
Well, maybe we could do it at another time, Mr. Chair. That might be a better option.
We will get a full report on that.
All right.
Both bodies. Senator Choi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, along the outreach line, and I don't know, today's probably not today, but as you know, many of our American Indians in Minnesota have proudly served this country and are now veterans. And they are hugely underserved. And we did appropriate some money to tribal service officers last year. And in your report to the committees on outreach, I would like you to include that as how you are doing in that area, if you could, please.
And Commissioner, we have Kate Beyer, and I'm sure Tim Michaels furiously taking notes, so they'll remind you to come in with those reports.
Chair Dunphy, Senator Scoy, we have since found out that the Tribal Service Officer Program, which came forward, is the first in the nation to make the Tribal Service Officer state employees. We have, is there seven in place, Michael?
Yes.
There are seven in place, and there's a couple others that we are talking about. I would love to make a report on that also, and so as we move forward.
And certainly there are a lot of initiatives we put forward last year, and
yes,
there's some supplemental stuff probably being asked for this year, so we will be focusing on the use of those dollars and see if they're being utilized the way we envisioned.
Yes.
So,
okay,
so please continue.
So to the report, so the one part of it deals with the Minneapolis home. The other part is the general part about vision for, and there are some things that I want to point out. The guidelines for an advisory board that the commission came forward with are being followed almost verbatim. It is called a health care advisory council. It is going through the open enrollment open appointment process as we speak, and it is our intention to expand upon that in the conversation with the deputy commissioner. I mean, he's very used to working with council. He had talked about before he got here, you know, making regular contact with family councils, with VA staff, with, you know, so I mean, we would welcome a chance to have ex-official involvement. We will be reaching out to other agencies. So here is what we have talked about. There are many, many recommendations in the commission's report. What we envision is having I don't know if we'll call it this, but a scorecard of the recommendations that came forward from the commission. And we want to deal with these point by point as we go forward. Now, obviously, that's not going to happen in the first meeting or the first second meeting, but it gives us an outline of a direction that we can move. And it is not our intention to have this commission report gathered dust. This will become a living document that will be referred to as we move forward.
I agree, and we should save these reports in our folders.
Absolutely.
Members. We'll be using them. Senator Vickerman.
Well, Mr. Chair, Dyrud, a couple of questions. I'm going to read them off as long as we're in this process. The first one is going to do with staffing. The Veterans Home Board has an office staff of 15 FTEs and a budget of nearly $1.5 million.
Will that budget and staff support transfer to the Department of Veterans Affairs? That's my first question. The second part of that, do you want to answer
first? Let's answer that one first.
Okay.
Chair,
Senator, Chair.
This is confusing. You're both chairs, so how do I do this?
Protocol-wise.
chair. the executive order moved the entire Veterans Home staff under Department of Veterans Affairs, and at the time of transfer, I believe it was 12 FTEs. They are part of the Department of Veterans Affairs. There is a relationship and a connection. The organization chart, which we will have when we start testifying by February, it will show very clearly where we are sharing staff and where there is separate staff. It starts with the org chart will start with the commissioner, and it breaks immediately at that point into health care, which is the vet homes, and the existing department. And within that, it will follow down the various programs, but there is shared staff. We will share a legislative director. For example, I think you know Christine Keel. She will be legislative director for, you know, all issues relating to, you know, the homes, our other budget. And we will have a communications director. There will be the business manager or a title to be determined as we go forward. There will be discussions of the budget and finance, not only from the individual homes, but our department, and then as it comes together. Right now, it is quite clear which committees have had jurisdiction over the homes and over us. And we are going under the assumption that continues, and if not, we will work. I mean, you let us know. Matt, is your
commissioner, the budgets are transferred too, right?
Yes.
So we're under the assumption that now it's all Veterans Affairs, and that's where you're sitting right now. So as far as oversight goes, legislatively, I don't think we're going to split departments apart and take little pieces of budgets and go elsewhere.
You
stand alone before, so I'm just throwing that out. Obviously, I'm not the Speaker of the House or the Majority Leader in the Senate, but certainly this committee. I know it's our intent as an oversight fiscal committee that we will be looking and sharing those budgets. And I don't know how we'd do it any other way, because frankly, we want it to be the least confusion also. And so everything is there. I mean, it's clear there's no more Veterans Homes Board. That's gone.
Correct.
It's hard to get that out of our vernacular. It's Department of Veterans Affairs, and they oversee veterans' homes out around the state is the way we need to start addressing things. And so, and we will. And so I think to answer the question, though, all staff, all budgets have been 100% transferred by the executive order into the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Correct.
Okay. And second question.
My second question would be the administrative funding. The report notes that the budget for administration of the Veterans Home System represents about 2% of the total expenditure. The commission recommends funding this at 3-5%, if I got my figures right. Commissioner Dyrud, will the department request additional spending on administration? It comes under administration right now, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
We need to know when we start putting our packages together, are you going to request another 3-5%?
Commissioner, are you looking at the supplemental budget possibilities and where you at on that process?
Chair, we are obviously looking at the supplemental budget. I believe, as I mentioned earlier, well, here, this is a good way to look at the only thing that has changed since November 19th is that the 9-member board is no longer in existence. The functioning of each home should remain the same, and then the last element, the only other aspect that's affected are what you refer to as the home board staff, which was 12 people. We have, for example, what I just mentioned, we have a legislative person. We can have a shared using of positions. Are we going to ask for that additional budget? I'm not so sure. As Chairman Thompson pointed out, four
facilities are multiple facilities, you know, having, you know, 3 to 5% for operations is not that much out of line. We are under that. And we also have been doing this for 5 weeks, 6 weeks, so we are still in the process of joining. I just cannot answer definitively today.
Well, Mr. Dyrud, you're looking at two co-chairs here that have got enough guts to ask for more money. And if you need it, I want to know about it, and not 12th of February. I'd like to know about that a little quicker so we can kind of get our numbers together. And I don't think I could find a better time.
Yeah,
the general public would support veterans issues than like now.
Mm-hmm.
So let's not be hesitant to ask. If you don't ask, you won't get, I can tell you that.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Commissioner, I agree with Senator Vickerman. We want to provide the resources necessary in a prudent manner, and that also goes for physical facilities. I know there were two office spaces, two sets of equipment, two sets of... I mean, is there something, frankly, that we need in the bonding bill to help? I know it's late, but I've done later things. Over at Veterans Affairs, if you are assimilating those folks in at the end of a lease or doing something, it's two more years till the next bonding bill. So if there's something that needs to be done there, too, we need to understand that fairly quickly.
Yes. Chair and chair, the what has been referred to as the home board space, which is in the west wing, is still there. We also have a place out in the historic Building 10, which is just kind of a signature piece of the Vets home. It's a tower. It goes back to the 1800s. That was renovated and up to date. Our deputy commissioner and some of the key staff will be located there. Our department, again, thanks to you, has been growing. We are busting at the seams. We have space. In fact, one of the tribal service officers for the city center's court will be located in this. We are expanding. And so we are envisioning that. We have use of both the Building 10 and the facilities downtown. But I do not at this time foresee needing additional space. We are reconfiguring our...
certainly we'll continue to review that with you.
Yes.
I have a question from Senator Erickson Ropes, and I want to get to saying hi to the new deputy commissioner.
Yes.
Who's been sitting there patiently before we leave for lunch, because once this crew goes to lunch, it's hard to get them back, Deputy.
Yeah. So,
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner, and welcome, Deputy Commissioner. In light of your comment, Representative Dunkey, about providing resources to the commissioner, I just want to let this body know that I joked with the commissioner a couple times during the task force meeting, said if we are going to toss him this hot potato, we ought to give him the potholders to catch it. And of course, then we're talking about resources. And it's great to have a deputy commissioner on board, because I think that's one of the resources or potholders that's going to need to manage this hot potato. But reflecting on what you said earlier about oversight and governance, and when situations arise, there seems to be a disconnect. And now that we've moved it under the Department of Veterans Affairs, I would like this body to consider something that I've talked to Senator Vickerman about, the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader, and that is, I wonder if we should think about putting together a bicameral, bipartisan, small subcommittee of health and veterans representatives or legislators to work directly with the new deputy commissioner. Because when we're looking at the veterans committees, as we are here, it's a huge group. If we put the healthcare group together, it's still a huge group. And those committees are going to want to hear what's happening. But in a realistic way, you probably shouldn't need to be needing 40, 45 people working directly with veterans and healthcare issues. I wonder if it would make more sense, since we have a brand new position dealing with not only veterans issues, but healthcare issues, that we look at either a temporary until we figure out how this is going to work, or whether you want to call it a task force, subcommittee, whatever, some kind of legislative body to mirror the new position that we've just created.
Certainly something we can look at. Thank you for that. Commissioner, and soon you want to introduce here before we get out of here the new deputy, and we'll move on to Deputy Commissioner Acevedo.
Yes, I would just like to say a couple words for those of you who are not in the military. Our new deputy commissioner was a command master chief in the Navy. That's as high as you can go in the enlisted ranks. There are officers, they're enlisted. There are not many command master chiefs, and you have to be a pretty sharp individual to get that. He retired. He was an Army nurse, but he was more than that. He's a medic and spent years in the Marine Corps. But
I'll let her
Oh, you mean the men's department of the Navy.
Hey, the room will come to order.
All right. Yeah. Well, they, since retiring, he spent about 6 or 7 years with the the California Department of Veterans Affairs, coming through the ranks and ending up administrator of the Chula Vista Veterans Home, which is a 400-bed facility outside of San Diego. We're very fortunate. The home for this started a search, a national search, and he surfaced about a year ago when it was sort of like landing a fish to get him here. But he is here in the middle of winter, just arriving a week ago, and I would like to introduce Gil Acevedo.
Well, welcome, Deputy Commissioner Acevedo, and certainly we're looking forward to a lot of conversations with you, but I think mostly we want to understand what it was like to work under the governor of California. You could introduce yourself. Welcome to the committee in about 3-4 minutes here before we're going to go to lunch, but welcome your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. It's an honor to be here. As the commissioner mentioned, I am a Navy veteran, hospital corpsman, have a passion for health care, have a passion for veteran issues. Coming from California, where the care at the facility that I was the administrator was just superb. And I say that with a lot of pride because that's my passion. I want to make sure if we're going to do something, we do it right. I want to thank Mr. Thompson and the commission for the hard work. That is a roadmap that I'm going to use. I've already started to take the commission report apart and put it in a fashion that I can understand and also articulate to the administrators and other people within the organization structure. With this being my first day of my second week in Minnesota, I want to thank all of you for bringing the beautiful weather that I enjoyed last week. I understand that's not going to last much longer, but it's been absolutely wonderful. Everybody's received me great, and I appreciate it. My family and I both. Very quickly, one of the things I want to do is, Mr. Thompson mentioned, is developing a vision, again, coming from the commission report, as a roadmap, developing a strategic plan, working with the Family Council. I had the opportunity to meet them today, dynamic group, great ideas, and I've always worked with the Family Council and found that is an awesome group to work with, and they really truly have a passion for what happens with the veterans. Partnership with the VA, where I come from, we had a working relationship with the VA where I was constantly working with the CEO, director of the VA hospital. We had shared agreements. We worked with all of their rehab services, and there was not an ancillary service that we didn't touch. And so that's something that I want to look at. I've already met the CEO of the VA hospital here. We've already talked about setting up a meeting and coming up and partnership with the Department of Health Services. I've already met key members of the Department of Health Services, and I want to make that a very good relationship as well. The Ombudsman's Office had the opportunity when I moved from the chair over there to the chair over here to talk to the Ombudsman's Office, and again, that's a close relationship that I need to develop as well. The other long-term care organizations is important. But most importantly, as everyone has been noting here, the involvement of the veterans community, all of the veterans service organizations that are out there with their eyes and ears open looking out for veteran issues. It's just an honor to be here. I'm looking forward to engaging in this opportunity. It's heavy lifting, and it's not going to be easy. I'm not fooling myself. It's going to be a challenge, but I'm ready for the challenge. Thank you.
Very good. Any questions for the new deputy commissioner?
Well, just a comment.
Senator Kubley.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. As a member of the, a veteran of the Air Force, I might just like to add that the weather in Minnesota is the only thing known in the country that builds character faster than the Marine Corps.
Mr. Chair, I want to make a comment also that I served in the Navy for 23 years. About half of that time I spent with the Marine Corps. A good part of that was underwater in the submarine force. But the best branch of service in our house, as my wife reminds me, is the Air Force, but she's an Air Force veteran.
All right. Well, with that, again, we're going to break for lunch and then hope to get back here roughly 12:30. We're in adjournment. 1:30. All right. Welcome back for those of you that are back, and I'm sure we'll see some trickle in. Appreciate everyone's time this morning. Hope you had a good lunch. This afternoon, again, if you remember, and I'm sure you all do, you all in the legislative bill last year requested a study basically on returning veterans or other needs out there, particularly as it has to do with mental health care. And I'm going to lay the groundwork here for why that was done so everyone understands in this room. A number of years ago, we started working on a facility in Willmar, Minnesota, which just happens to be my hometown. But surveys were done. There's a process you go through when you seek out a veteran facility. First of all, you do surveys, and we did those surveys. Then the legislature appropriated pre-design money, and that's all done. And then you work to get federal funding along with the state funding. That's all. We're on the federal list out there. But this facility was slated to be a mental health facility, particularly for World War II veterans. But obviously we've learned, and I think progressed to the point that we understand there's mental health issues with all ages of veterans. And in particular, we were wondering, what are we going to be seeing with this group of returning Iraqi and Afghanistan veterans who are over in that theater, both now and into the future? Because I think that's one of the things was the theme today. If there's any theme today, it's can we plan for the future? Let's look beyond the end of our nose. Let's have a little foresight and try and understand what our needs are going to be 5 and 10 and 20 years down the line. So before we push to move that Willmar facility forward, we asked for a study to say, not only for Willmar, but for the entire state, what are those needs out there? So let's not build a facility that doesn't work or that isn't flexible. And indeed, I can tell you the new designs, if you've ever been to Fergus Falls, some of you have, that is the new type of veteran facilities that is night and day compared to the older ones, Silver Bay, Minneapolis, and others. They're modular pod designs. They can be retrofitted in different ways. They can be utilized in different ways for different age groups. We think about that, particularly, I always tell people, think of a recreational, a rec room for a World War II vet versus someone who's 21 years old and coming home from Iraq. What would that recreational room look like? It's a lot different, you know. Think of the video game story that you don't play, but the kids do. So there's so many of those things that I think we need a new awareness of. But most importantly, what we're going to discover through this report, and some of you have read it, and some of you haven't, but obviously part of the charge and the was not only to do the report, but to bring that information to the legislature. I think this is extremely, and I know Senator Vickerman can chime in here too, I think this is an extremely important document, and I think it's something also that we're going to need to share with our health and Human Services Committees, because it's that important what you're going to learn today from these two gentlemen. Senator Bickerman?
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, I think this is probably one of the most important piece of legislation that we've put together. We can have nursing homes. But we're now into this post-traumatic stress brain damage. There's a little more of a story here. We're getting into female veterans, or female veterans that we didn't probably see before. So now we're looking at another group. And it's just like I visited with them this morning. I go to my home doctor, and once in a while there's a female doctor there, and I feel kind of embarrassed to go there. But my wife says, "Well, why? I have to go to a male doctor. It don't bother me any." But I'm just saying, it's easy for us to sit here, but for them to get to come. And this is a hidden disease, it's a hidden tragedy that they've had. That's not easy to assess. No soldier should commit suicide. That makes me sick. And there's a lot of them every week in the country. All we got to do is be able to get to them. And so I want all of you to work together here. I don't play politics with veterans issues. I never have, and I'm not going to start. I don't think we should. But let's get together. Let's get something. We need to find some money, as I said earlier. I don't have nothing against going and asking for more money. I might not get it, but I'll bet I'll get a good share of it before we're done. So let's just all work together, and this is one thing that we need to do. And I'm glad you two gentlemen are here, and let's hear a little bit more about it.
And and I agree 100% with Senator Bickerman, and I think I speak for the committee and legislature in saying we are going to see to it that we take care of these veterans. Especially the new ones coming back. We've stumbled in the past with some groups, but no more, Senator Bickerman. We're, as a state, going to take care of those folks.
As I said once before, Mr. Co-Chair, there will never be another Vietnam, not as long as I remember.
That's right. And under full disclosure, I have a son who's ready to deploy to Iraq May 1st, or June 1st. He'll be on the ground, feet on the ground, Representative Severson, September 1st.
He didn't know what that means.
Yeah, that's right. He was an air guy too, wasn't he? Okay. And under other full disclosure, I have a female doctor too, so I'm just like you. I it's just a thing with me and Bickerman. Okay.
My wife says I'm a chicken.
That's a folder story. Folder story. Everyone else. Anyone else want to anything they want to mention? All right. With that, we do have a report here in about an hour. Hopefully, we can get through it and learn some things. We have Dr. Bill Sheehan and Steve Thurber here, and we're going to hand it over to you. All we ask is that you introduce yourself for the tape so the tape recognizes the voice and puts it with the name, and please proceed in any way you see fit.
Thank you very much, Representative Junkie, and it's a great honor to be here. My name is William Sheehan. I'm a psychiatrist from Wilmer.
My name is Stephen Thurber, a psychologist from Wilmer.
And it's probably helpful to give you a little bit of background as to how this report came to be. And as Representative Junkie mentioned, that he had started planning for a facility in Wilmer several years ago. And at that time, the needs had been seen perhaps in a little bit different terms than they are today. By the same token, about 3 years or so ago, I started becoming very interested, for other reasons, in traumatic brain injury. And even though most of my career has been spent in psychiatry, I started recognizing a large number of patients that had had traumatic brain injury among my psychiatric patients, and finding them showing up in large numbers in other aspects of the psychiatric healthcare system. So I had really decided to become a specialist with the traumatic brain injury several years ago, and found that this was an area that really was a frontier. It's an area that traditional medicine has not really taken much cognizance of, and doesn't really know very much about how to go towards assessing and treating it. The other thing that happened in the meantime was that we faced a challenge that I don't think any of us expected back in 2003 when we started our involvement in Iraq. And namely, that was that all of our preparations and planning based on previous experiences, such as Vietnam, were not adequate to the challenges that we were going to face. And the particular challenge was the improvised explosive devices, which have caused a great deal of havoc with our troops from the standpoint of causing closed head injuries, the type of injury that we're going to give you some background about, but it's really a different kind of a challenge than we've faced in the past. So we've had to learn a great deal along the way, and we've had to become somewhat flexible and change our priorities perhaps a bit from what we would have expected. So I think as you've all been thinking about a veterans home for World War II vets, we've encountered a need that we didn't know about probably when this process started. Traumatic brain injury really is going to be the main focus, although we will be also talking a bit about post-traumatic stress disorder and try to give you some information from the standpoint of how to distinguish the two disorders and have an idea of how they differ and in some ways how they overlap. This is a quote from the Commander-in-Chief of the Department of, or the Veterans of Foreign Wars organization. The public doesn't know the true extent of these brain injuries. Indeed, while the mainstream media offers a steady stream of fatal casualty statistics, it is less common to see in-depth examinations of the physical wounds of war. It is a subject that demands the attention of the American people. These are their defenders being unalterably changed for life. And it is the public that will be expected to foot the bill for whatever finances it takes for their physical and vocational rehabilitation. And certainly I couldn't agree more. So for our purposes, traumatic brain injury is going to be seen as that subset of intracranial brain injuries in which the damage of the brain occurs as a result of a sudden forceful blow or impact to the head. Now in the past, generally these injuries have been associated with projectile wounds. What's different about the Afghan and Iraq theaters is that actually a lot of these people are sustaining injuries from blast explosions, and we'll describe more about that, but without any ostensible injury. There's no damage to the integument, and there isn't. These people can look quite normal, quite unharmed, and yet have suffered grievous injuries. And Dr. Thurber is going to mention a little bit about post-traumatic stress, and because that certainly is what we've been more prepared to deal with from the standpoint of particularly the Vietnam era.
And Dr. Thurber, you just introduce yourself so the tape will recognize the voice.
Stephen Thurber. Well, the first point to be made, I think, is that there's an overlap in symptoms between traumatic stress disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, and TBIs. Post-traumatic stress disorder, as the term implies, refers to an event that is experienced in a very traumatic, fear-evoking fashion. Post means that after the event itself, the individual may relive the event, that is, will have flashbacks of various types. The person may dream about the event. The individual becomes very hyper-vigilant, that is, over-concerned about any possible event that may trigger memory traces of the traumatic event itself. The individual may avoid situations, therefore, that may trigger memory traces. But even when they don't encounter events or stimuli that trigger memory traces, they may nonetheless have flashbacks, dreams of the event itself. Now, the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder include all of those things that we've talked about, but in addition, there can be problems in the progression of thinking and the content of thinking. The post-traumatic stress disorder is anxiety. Anxiety is a free-floating fear state that is with the individual most of the time unless appropriate treatments are found. The individual will have sleep problems, I've already talked about, dreams of the traumatic event.
problems with concentration, problems with attention, problems with memory. And these are some of the symptoms that may overlap with the TBI situation.
I know it was mentioned that when the facility was originally projected, it was for World War II veterans, and both the Vietnam era vets and also the Iraq-Afghan vets coming back, they do have some different needs. A lot of them do suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, and where some of the older World War II vets are, you know, quite sociable and like to be in the thick of things where there's a lot of activity going on, these are people that generally find a lot of stimulation overwhelming, and they prefer conditions where they might have more solitude and ability to control stimulation. So there are some factors of that. Now, let me emphasize, this is an important point, one of the points that I think we're going to try to make over and over again, because it's still a source of a lot of confusion, and I even see this misquoted in newspapers and things, but traumatic brain injury is not a psychological concern. There may be manifestations of a psychological nature, but traumatic brain injury does occur in a setting in which there's a demonstrable or presumed injury to the organ of the brain. And there is a lot of overlap between TBI and PTSD. And a recent study showed that PTSD occurs in about 40% of the veterans coming back with brain damage, but it occurs in 50% of those without the brain damage. And the reason for the discrepancy is that some of the patients that have more severe brain injuries have damage to the parts of the brain that are involved in memory and anxiety responses. But there is a lot of overlap between these kinds of things, and as we'll see, there are some consequences of that, because it leads to the possibility of there being significant misdiagnosis and mistreatment. Just to give you a little bit of background, because this is also, I think, important for the legislature to realize, despite the fact that this has sort of risen unexpectedly on our horizon with the veterans issues, actually traumatic brain injury is an extremely widespread and important problem, and it's one that has led the Centers for Disease Control to call it the silent epidemic. 1.5 million Americans suffer from traumatic brain injury every year, and 257,000 are hospitalized and survive. So just to give you an idea, that's 20 times the rate of hospitalizations from spinal cord injuries, you know, the kind that lead to a person becoming a quadriplegic or a paraplegic, and 50,000 deaths each year. These are injuries that far exceed the number of cases of other kinds of problems that we prioritize in healthcare. For instance, the rates of traumatic brain injury are 10 times that of breast cancer. It's 10 times that of HIV. And yet, we don't really have a very good system for dealing with this, particularly after the acute stages, after the trauma has been initially addressed. It's a huge problem for our whole society from the standpoint that adolescents and young adults, who of course are still at the beginning of their productive careers, are those that are most at risk. And the most common causes are vehicular crashes in that population. And then in younger children and older adults, of course, it's falls. Sports-related injuries are another area we'll briefly talk about. Males are twice as likely to experience TBI as females. Alcohol is associated with half. And rural areas have the highest rates. The states that have the lowest populations are those that have the highest incidence of traumatic brain injury. Now, what's important to keep in mind, even with regard to our more narrow purview of talking about veterans affairs, is the disproportionate number of the veterans are coming from rural areas. I mean, the rural areas have twice the recruitment levels of metropolitan areas into the military. And a lot of these people, just by virtue of the demographics, will have had traumatic brain injuries prior to entry in the military. And one of the problems with traumatic brain injury is that repeated incidents of traumatic brain injury become cumulative and lead to more devastating effects. Some of the soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan have had as many as 6 closed head injuries from blast injuries. So this is a significant problem both from the standpoint of rural Minnesota, but also specifically with regard to the veterans. Now, the brain is, of course, a rather vulnerable organ. It has been described as about an organ that looks a little bit like a bad pudding, and weighs about 3 pounds, and it resides within the bony structure to protect it. This is a skull, actually, from Neolithic Britain, sort of the people that built Stonehenge, and they found out that traumatic brain injury was quite common in those days, and it has been throughout human history, which is why we've developed various protective devices in order to protect ourselves from traumatic brain injury. This is a sidebar to our discussion, but it may be helpful to note that there's been increasing recognition of the fact that repeated concussions have delayed effects for people like boxers and even football players. And this is an article in the Minneapolis Star Tribune about a former Viking football player who had been an honor student at Stanford before he went into the National Football League, was sustained a serious brain injury in his first preseason game, and has since fallen into a downward spiral of headaches, fatigue, dizziness, depression, and forgetfulness. John Mackey, of course, is an example of a person that's become a bit of an icon for this problem, but he is now struggling with premature dementia at an early age. And that's another important point to make here, is that there can be long delays between the time of the injuries and when these problems start to manifest. And in particular, anyone that's sustained a traumatic brain injury has twice as high a likelihood of developing Alzheimer's as somebody that's not sustained a traumatic brain injury. Another problem is that somebody that's had one traumatic brain injury is four times more likely to have a second one. So these are problems that tend to be somewhat cumulative. We're going to talk now more about the Iraq and Afghanistan situation.
By the way, Phil and I are aware of research on boredom, and we decided that if we traded off like the
psychological thing. We're like Abbott and Costello without the humor. And Dr. Thurber, just make sure you get close to that microphone too. It'll help the audience here.
Well, as you can see on the screen, the improved body armor is an important issue here. Compared to every single death, there are 8 injuries in the Afghanistan and Iraqi war. And that's in sharp contrast to the ratio in the Vietnam War. Now, the fact that we have more survivors in the current war situation is important to note. And what these individuals are experiencing in terms of so-called blast injuries is something profound, and we still need a lot of research on the effects of such injuries. You have a shock wave from these various explosive devices, and that shock wave is over pressure that affects pervasive amounts of brain tissue. What exactly happens? There is some indication that parts of the brain cells will be affected, called axons. The brain may atrophy, may be lower in volume. There are many possibilities here. But you have the shock wave, and then there's an after effect. Because the air has been displaced, the air returns to the areas of deficit, so to speak, and so you have a second effect on the brain. So these are unique kinds of injuries that have never been seen before in the history of civilization.
And just to give you some sense, these are some of the figures about the magnitude of the problem, and we'll talk a little bit more about the nature of the injuries, but since 2001, the U.S. military has reported about 15% of all the wounded that had struggled with a traumatic brain injury. Now, they diagnosed 4,471 cases of TBI. However, all of these were cases involving open head wounds, namely injuries where shrapnel entered the skull and, you know, there was actual tissue that was emerged from the outlet. they're not including veterans with closed head injuries, and those are the ones that we're really concerned about, the ones that have been the result of blast injuries. And when these are included, according to the Brain Injury Association of America, the TBI tally skyrockets. There have been about 20,000 so far as of September 2007. And because, again, a lot of these may be unrecognized at the time and only start to become symptomatic later, the estimates from various authorities suggest that the number could eventually reach 150,000. So this has the potential to become a huge public health issue for our veterans. Just as a sidebar, I noticed that there was a statistic recently that the economy has just exceeded Iraq as the public's number one priority in some polls. And I think that one of the pressing issues that we have here is there's a window of opportunity. I think everybody right now is very aware of the sacrifices and the excellent service that these men and women have provided to us. But it's real easy when these kinds of problems are delayed in time to forget about this and to allow these issues to slip below the radar screen. I saw that happen in my training, which was largely with the post-Vietnam era veterans. And so I think that this issue does have high priority, both from the standpoint that the most effective treatments are those that are administered immediately, but also because this is an issue currently that enjoys a level of interest and support from the community that may dissipate over time. So the injuries that these people have had due to blast injuries have proved to be the most problematic, disabling, and difficult to recognize and treat of all the conditions that are affecting our service people. Blast injuries affect more widespread parts of the brain than typical shell fragment injury, and the damage is extremely variable and unpredictable. Initial symptoms may be subtle. They may be missed by soldiers, family members, and doctors. That may affect troop readiness because troops that may not be ready to return to combat because of these injuries may be sent prematurely into combat. The same issue, of course, is faced with young athletes going back into action in the sports type of a setting with, you know, concussions and things like that. Even mild TBI can lead to significant problems, chronic unemployment, substance abuse, suicide. Certain types of brain injury are associated with a lack of awareness of the deficit, so the person may not be aware themselves of how severely damaged they are. Though the classic symptoms are fairly easy to recognize, and typically they include seizures, headaches, sleep disorders, memory problems, problems with attention and concentration, the symptoms may be delayed, and when they do appear, they may not be recognized as symptoms of TBI. And commonly, these are symptoms such as memory loss, short attention spans, muddled reasoning, confusion, anxiety, depression, irritability. And most people in the field of mental health will probably diagnose those as due to a primary mental health condition rather than recognizing it as due to an underlying neurological injury. So therefore, these symptoms are often mistaken for psychological problems such as PTSD or personality disorder. I know we talked about the diagnosis of personality disorders a bit when we were out at lunch, and a study that was just done at Fort Carson near Colorado Springs reported 40 soldiers who actually had traumatic brain injury were actually misdiagnosed as having personality disorders. So doctors do tend to attribute these kinds of problems more to psychological problems rather than to traumatic brain injury.
Just in the general field of evaluation of possible traumas to the brain, many practitioners, and this is being brought up in research literature, wait 90 days after a trauma to the brain before evaluation because the symptoms do not always appear initially, but appear later on within a 90-day time interval. We do have some information on factors that may mediate the effect of trauma. For example, the amount of brain tissue involved in closed head injuries will determine the severity of the symptoms shown. The age of the individual is another important factor here. And the younger the person, the more likely we have a readjustment of the brain, as one brain center will take over for brain centers that have been damaged. and so on. So we have an idea as to the mediators, as to the severity of symptoms.
I'll just briefly talk about this. I've already made the point, but as with traumatic brain injury itself, rural populations are disproportionately affected by the results of service-connected blast injuries, because, of course, the great majority of U.S. military recruits do tend to come disproportionately from rural areas. Just within Willmar itself, there's a population of about 20,000. We've had two soldiers that have been killed in Iraq, so we're quite familiar with the losses that have been sustained. Now, one of the problems is, of course, that these are people who have sustained a head injury. The symptoms may not be apparent right away. We don't yet have particularly good ways of assessing these things on a large scale. And these are people that will go back to rural communities where there's often limited resources. And they are very likely to be either lost to follow-up or they may not be appropriately diagnosed and treated. And this is certainly one of the reasons why I would argue that we should have a major resource for both diagnosing and assessing and treating patients in a rural location, because, first of all, rather intimidating for a lot of people to get their care, as excellent as that care may be, in the metropolitan area. And we'll see a little bit more about some of the results of our survey. But and also, I think there are some cultural issues that make it very difficult for people that are working in a primarily metropolitan, centralized, large bureaucratic center to understand the particular issues that rural veterans might face. And this is just a quote. Again, tendency for people that have these injuries to be seen as having primary mental health problems. This is actually a patient of mine that has sustained a head injury a number of years ago, and has been a very dynamic businessman, and was diverted into all sorts of psychological and psychiatric treatments. Eventually, I was able to make the diagnosis of traumatic brain injury, and he asked me this, Doc, am I nuts or do I have TBI? Since I started doing my work in traumatic brain injury, I found lots of people that have been miscategorized. I've never found one yet that would rather be nuts than TBI. So it is actually a great relief to patients, even apart from the fact that once you get in on the right track, you're more likely to be able to be helpful. Now these are patients that have been around for a long time. This is a friend of mine, actually, who's in Britain. And, of course, patients that had traumatic brain injury really go back probably to the Civil War, but certainly World War I with the trench warfare and all of that sort of thing. But I have memories from my boyhood of shell shock victims of trench warfare from World War I. Born in 1930, I remember a great many men about who had been severely injured in that way. I knew several. One was a master at my own King's School. Boys being boys took advantage of his bumbling ways, and he was often reduced to a state of chaos. And, of course, in World War I, shell shock was thought to be something that was really a psychological thing and sometimes equated with a lack of courage. And a lot of these people actually did have serious brain injuries. This is just to kind of personalize this and give you a little bit more of an idea of what these veterans that are coming back, and as Representative Duncan mentioned, or may have been Representative Vickerman, the fact that this is cutting across both male and female. This is a patient that was reviewed in the DFW magazine that just came out, which has an excellent article that I would highly recommend. But this woman, Linda Brasher, is a 53-year-old mother from Louisville, Kentucky, was involved in an attack on her Army unit in Baghdad in October 2006. She has some symptoms since then that would be commensurate with a PTSD diagnosis, cannot fall asleep without the comfort of a light, radio, TV. And the horrors were sort of continuing all night and into the morning, and she said nothing has been the same since. Now, as Dr. Thurber mentioned, she was observed by doctors for several weeks for signs of a concussion. Her comment is, if you're not bleeding or losing a limb or eyesight, you're not medically evacuated. Later, she developed headaches, memory loss, insomnia, balance problems, and dizziness. As often is the case, those problems were attributed to psychological issues, and she was initially diagnosed with PTSD, reevaluated when she returned stateside to Fort McCoy in Wisconsin, and after they examined her medically, they sent her to Walter Reed, and an MRI showed she had sustained damage to the left superior cerebellum in her brain. Brashears felt relieved to hear the diagnosis of moderate TBI and said, "I felt vindicated. It justified my pain and feeling that something more was going on there." So these are patients that are going to suffer from an array of problems, some of which may be misdiagnosed as psychological. These are difficult to diagnose because they do often overlap with psychological problems. The reason for that being that all of these symptoms that we consider to be psychological are generated within the organ of the brain. So if the organ of the brain is damaged, it's going to affect a person's mood, cognitions, all of those kinds of things. And those CT scans are now the diagnostic imaging of choice in TBI cases. They routinely do fail, both CT and MRI, fail to pick up on brain injuries. And that's an interesting question, because we spend literally billions of dollars a year evaluating patients with CT scans and MRIs, even though the yield for those is very low, because as we'll see, that they don't correlate very well with the function of the brain.
Does everyone know what a CT scan is and MRI? Mm-hmm.
These kinds of things can be subtle. This is a person, 31-year-old Army sergeant, who received multiple injuries. Immediately treated for knee, hearing, and vision problems, but the TBI went unrecognized for over a year. Now, one of the things about these blast injuries is that they do tend to also, because they involve a very concentrated force, blow out eardrums and destroy the small bones in the ears. So one clue as to the sustaining of a TBI injury is when patients come back with significant hearing loss. So that's certainly a clue. And again, I can't emphasize enough, there's a degree of urgency about this because, though as Dr. Thurber mentioned, the brain possesses a certain degree of flexibility and neuroplasticity, and it can repair and retrain itself within certain limits. Generally, anything that isn't addressed within the first year or two is likely to become more or less permanent. So it's really important to first make the right diagnosis and then introduce some of the kinds of treatments that are helpful. And a lot of those treatments, as we'll see, more involve rehabilitation kinds of procedures than medications and things of that sort. And So what happens to these people after they return? Obviously, a lot of them will struggle with workplace performance commonly, and we're seeing this already with the returning veterans, professional and personal relationships deteriorating. Many will be given psychiatric diagnoses, and if they do receive treatment, they may receive what treatment they do receive, some of it inappropriate by mental health practitioners. And this is probably the most poignant slide that I can show you. Others, and probably the majority, will end up as chronic mental health patients, patients in chemical dependence treatment programs, or other marginal groups receiving their care through prisons, jails, homeless shelters, and soup kitchens. So we have a choice. We have a choice to spend the money that's needed to provide these people with the kind of treatment that they deserve and that they demand, or else we'll be treating them in other sectors of our economy that are probably not as appropriate. And Dr. Thurber is going to just run you through this, but all of these populations are populations where we've documented enormous rates of traumatic brain injury, and also a significant number of people in these populations are former military.
Well, as you can see from the slide, many persons with traumatic brain injuries end up in prisons and the correctional system. Having worked in the California prison system, I can testify that this is certainly the case in that state. Why would they show up in departments of corrections and prisons? Well, if you think of the symptoms of TBIs, the problems in memory, the emotional problems, anxiety and depression and the like. And if you have a brain that has been affected by blast injuries, for example, the areas of the brain related to control of actions may be impaired, such that the person is not able to plan effectively and execute that plan, that the person does not think about the consequences of actions. So the findings related to the congressional system make very good sense in that context.
It's interesting. A very innovative first time that this had ever been surveyed was in the Department of Southern Department of Corrections. There was a survey of 800 consecutive inmate admissions to the Minnesota Department of Corrections over 4 months during the summer of 2006. And when this report was first publicized at the Minnesota Brain Injury Association meeting, the people from the Department of Health said that it was just mind-boggling. But they found that 83% of the incoming inmates had sustained traumatic brain injury or multiple traumatic brain injuries. And they felt that that was more likely to be a floor than a ceiling because they were able to check those numbers against the brain injury register, you know, when people do have a brain injury and they're admitted to a hospital. And several of the people that had reported they'd not had a brain injury actually showed up on the register. So this is an astronomical rate. This is a study, I won't go through all the details, but it was a study at all of the shelters and meal programs in Toronto. And they found out that in this population, 72% of the patients had had, or people in these homeless shelters had had a TBI before they became homeless. And the rates of people that were homeless in the shelter actually was 52%. So, and a lot of these are military. I did a little survey that's not been published, but on the MICD unit in Wilmer, which is where a lot of the more refractory cases of chemical dependency sorts of issues are referred, and some of these people have been through 20 different treatment programs. We still tend to do sort of a 12-step model. And I found out that 70% of those people had a traumatic brain injury. So the rates of that population were 8 times that of the general population. Just on a general psychiatric ward in a community community hospital in Wilmer, I found the population of those patients that had traumatic brain injury was 2 to 3 times that of the general population. So just overall, we're missing this. We're missing this. And we're sending most of these people into other sorts of settings like mental health, corrections, homeless shelters. And these guys that are coming back are going to be part of that population unless we figure out a way of doing it better. Even a mild injury may lead to disruption of workplace performance, deterioration of personal and professional relationships, marriage difficulties. Psychiatric manifestations are protean. And this is interesting. Contrary to expectations, a number of surveys have shown that the patients who have mild to moderate traumatic brain injuries are much more affected by their emotional difficulties than by their residual physical difficulties. So this gentleman, I think we've all seen these kinds of people. Even though he has some physical disabilities, I think we would all be willing to believe that probably his emotional difficulties are a greater burden for him than the physical difficulties. High rates of mood, psychotic, and substance abuse disorders in patients that have had traumatic brain injury, and decades-long vulnerability to psychiatric illnesses. And the most common things are depression, delusional disorder, and personality changes. A lot of these people do use chemicals, and so the problems become sort of cumulative and intractable. And unfortunately, as I did see with the Vietnam era, one of the things that tends to happen to these people once you get farther and farther removed from the point of origin is, well, I think they had those problems before they entered the military. Or if they would just stop drinking, they wouldn't have the problem. Or if they'd stop beating up their wife or whatever, they should go into marriage counseling without our realizing that these are behaviors and symptoms that emerge out of the context that they've sustained a brain injury. By the same token, you know, if a person were to enter an emergency room complaining of chest pain because they were having some problems with their heart, I don't think very many emergency room doctors would say, well, this is just something you brought on yourself. You should have had less French fries. You should have maybe done a little bit more exercise. So out of my emergency room, you vagrants and miscreants or whatever. But we do tend to discriminate differently against mental health patients. And so one of the things that's actually occurred as a result of this war and the number of veterans coming back is that I think it's a tremendous opportunity. This is the first group cohort of combat veterans that have come back during an era when we can actually do functional brain imaging and do kinds of assessments that have never been possible before. And I think that through this experience, we may be finally able to realize that a lot of the mental health problems that we see are related to a disorder of the brain rather than due to behavioral choices that people make. So,
are we ready to talk about our survey?
Yeah, let's go ahead. We're just basically, before Dr. Thurber talked about that, I just want to introduce you to this concept because there is a mental health care in rural and frontier America initiative, and these are points that I won't belabor a lot, but the point is that there aren't very good definitions of what rural America constitutes, and people don't necessarily recognize, for instance, that more than 50% of rural Americans live in areas where there are mental health professional shortages. 90% of all psychologists and psychiatrists and 80% of social workers work exclusively in metropolitan areas. For instance, do you realize which city in the state of Minnesota has the highest per capita incidence of psychiatrists? Edina. I don't know if you can figure out a reason for that, but I don't think it necessarily means there are more mentally ill people in Edina. They may have a higher reimbursement rate. And more than 65% of rural Americans get their mental health care from their primary care provider. So there's a huge shortage in rural areas. And this is relevant, I think, to our final conclusions. But the acceptability of care in rural areas is often impaired because it's based on urban-based models and strategies, and a clearly defined plan to address these issues in rural areas does not exist, and mental health policy is routinely established without consideration of its rural impact. So, again, I'm sort of setting the stage for consideration that we may not be able to succeed in addressing these issues simply by, you know, funding more at the exquisite facility that we have in Minneapolis, the Veterans Hospital or the St. Cloud Hospital, because those are potentially resources that would not address these issues in a rural setting. And this is the results of our survey. And Dr. Thurber, you want to mention a little bit how we proceeded methodologically? And
yes, I will. To begin with, we had planned actually to survey returning service persons came back from the wards, and we were unable to do this for a variety of reasons. In lieu of that, we surveyed veteran service representatives, personnel in hospitals and community mental health centers throughout the state. We had a list of hospitals and community mental health centers randomly selected from that list. We surveyed clinicians who are deemed to be experts, that is, those who are board certified in specialty fields, and that would include neuropsychology, counseling psychology, clinical psychology. And then we also had personnel who contacted these various service agencies, hospitals, community mental health centers, and asked questions that typical persons with TBIs or post-traumatic stress disorder or chemically dependent individuals might ask. And the results.
First of all, it's interesting that when we initially contacted the Veterans Service Reps, and we had an outstanding response from them. They're very interested in this issue, and they responded with a tremendous amount of interest. But their expectations were that many of these people would be able to get immediate assistance or care within a week or less, and the results didn't bear that out. And in fact, these are some specific comments from some of the service reps, and they're not selected to particularly give a negative view of what's available out there, but these are fairly characteristic of what they actually reported.
They already mentioned their optimism was misplaced about the immediate assistance. The closest VA is in St. Cloud, but that is too far for them to drive. All local services are private. Local VA resources are not dependable. too many individuals and organizations trying to be the source of assistance to recent veterans, many with little or no experience dealing with the issues faced by servicemen and women. We have an accessibility problem. We live 100 miles from nowhere. We have 3 mental health facilities here, but none has any real experience with veterans' issues. The local VA outpatient clinic has high turnover of personnel. I've had major complaints of quality of service and lack of follow-up care. The reluctance of the individual to accept help is usually the problem. Alcohol accelerates the mental health concern, and things are done or said without a sound mind, complicating things. I think we could do a better job at unifying medical and mental health services and get a base of where they are at physically and mentally. They will feel more in the system by outreaching and opening our doors instead of waiting for them to come to us. More local and primary care in rural areas.
And we also did a survey of providers, which were randomly selected, and the respondents, which was a much lower rate of response, unfortunately, than service reps, were general hospitals, 80% were in that category, psychiatric hospitals, 7%, community mental health centers, 13%. We only had one urban or suburban facility that agreed to respond to our survey. 10 of the facilities that responded were serving small cities or towns within an hour's drive of the metro area. 71% were rural and one was extreme rural. And the surveyors also did follow-up queries asking to be connected with someone to help veterans experiencing difficulties. And this is what the interviewers reported, that the responses varied from very helpful and friendly, though often with multiple transfers within hospital, very long delays, to evasive, unhelpful, and downright rude. In general, this part of the survey indicated that veterans attempting to get help would most likely be referred to the VA system or another facility, told to access services through the emergency room, or simply informed that services for their conditions were not available. No facility surveyed demonstrated a well-integrated multi-specialty program that could address veterans' needs in a unified and comprehensive fashion, and most seemed to have little understanding of how to go about evaluating a patient with a traumatic brain injury, and most commonly what they suggested was that they could do a CT scan or an MRI. And in addition to the quantitative information, the own interviewers did volunteer this information. Some calls I made were very difficult, and persistence was necessary, and even then it was sometimes futile. Veterans and their families should not be put on hold 4 to 5 times to find out information about a facility. And very few receptionists or the first person to answer the phone knew very much about their facility. For example, do you do tests? Is there a psychiatrist? I didn't expect them to know how long it would take to get an appointment, but some general knowledge of what the facility offered would be helpful to callers. So the conclusion is that the current system for meeting the needs of these veterans and guardsmen is very haphazard and patchwork. There appear to be enormous obstacles, both logistical and institutional, and some of those logistical and institutional factors include that many of the facilities are located in metropolitan centers, whereas most of the potential patients are rural-based, that these issues are all particularly severe in rural areas. And really, apart from the VA system, there's virtually nothing available to meet the service-related. Needs, or even understanding what would be required to meet their needs. So, I should pause and ask, are there any questions or anything at this point? Because we're going to turn from sort of the evaluation of what the problem looks like to maybe some indications about what might be done to address that. So, do I have any questions, or should I plow on?
You've been doing a good job. I fully understand so far.
Okay, great. Thanks. Well, in terms of assessment, at the VA hospitals, there's a screening instrument that's used, the military acute concussion evaluation, and that has widespread use. There are some problems with these types of questionnaires. One is that they do tend to be more specifically directed towards acute kinds of injuries, and so they're not as useful in looking at the chronic results of these kinds of injuries. And any kind of a questionnaire is also limited in part by the fact that sometimes the veterans themselves, because of the brain injuries, aren't fully aware of their deficits. There are certainly behavioral neurological studies, neuropsych kinds of things. As I mentioned earlier, hearing loss could be a marker for brain injury.
But a lot of emphasis has been placed, as I mentioned earlier, and some of it misplaced on imaging studies. And the types of imaging studies that are available in rural areas really come down to CAT scans, MRIs, and single photon computerized tomography or SPECT. And this is going to be partly an extension of some of my own research, but basically what we have on the left side of the screen is a CAT scan of a patient. And so that is a very useful type of scan if what you're interested in is anatomical detail. In other words, if you're interested in ruling out a tumor, or you want to make sure that there isn't some sort of a collection of blood, like a subdural hematoma or a hemorrhage, but it doesn't correlate very well with function. And I can't tell you how many times I've had patients who have had severe disorders, neurological disorders or psychiatric disorders, that had a CAT scan that was done that was read as completely normal. On the right is a SPECT scan, and this is not a kind of like particularly cutting edge technology. It's used extensively for looking at function of the heart. We do thallium heart studies to look at perfusion deficits. We're not interested in taking a static picture of the heart that shows what it looks like. What we want to see is, how is the heart functioning? How is it filling with blood? How are the valves working? So we want to set the heart in motion. And it's also, these types of scans are done for patients that have cancer, because tumors are hot spots, so there's an increased amount of blood flow to the tumor site. And so those are very useful for those purposes. When I was at Rice Hospital, they'd had a SPECT scan for many years, where they had been doing basically evaluations of hearts and patients with cancer. They'd never done a brain scan with the SPECT machine. And so I started doing them, and I started getting some rather interesting results. I'm not the only person that has done this. There's been quite a bit of work in it, but it is interesting to show how this very useful technology had never been used before in the small hospital that I was at. Now, the way that a SPECT scan works is basically you have, and I'll try to be non-technical about this, but you have a radioisotope that is attached to a glucose molecule. Now, a radioisotope is basically something that decays. When it decays, it gives off a gamma ray, and then you can use a detector to pick up the gamma radiation, and that gives you an idea of blood flow to those parts of the brain. Glucose is the only fuel supply that the brain uses, so it goes very quickly into the brain. And so within 2 minutes, basically, we are able to determine what parts of the brain are the most active, because the brain is no different than any other part of the body. You know, if I do exercises with a barbell with this arm, more blood is going to be shunted into this arm than the one that's lying sort of passively at my side. And the same thing is true in terms of the brain. And so we can look at these kinds of images, and we can find out what parts of the brain are functioning normally and which parts aren't. And as I can only underscore as best I can, the brain may look completely normal but not be functioning well. And we're really interested in, how is the brain functioning? This isn't a beauty contest. You might have the prettiest brain in the legislature, but you really want to know, how is it functioning?
Don't get us started.
We did have a governor once. Wasn't there one that was called the brain once? So anyway, and an important factor complicating diagnosis is the common failure of MRIs or CT scans to pick up on brain injuries, especially mild injuries. Right now there's a study that's going on, and I've actually been in touch with these people at Evans Army Community Hospital at Fort Carson, Colorado, and they're using the SPECT imaging to see if that might be more useful in spotting brain injuries. But actually, it's already been done. We already know that SPECT is more sensitive than CT or MRI in detecting abnormalities. There are a number of different reports that have gone back into the 80s for this, and particularly mild MRI, mild head injuries. And I'm going to just briefly illustrate, this is the rural experience. We actually did a SPECT brain imaging initiative at Rice Memorial Hospital, which is a city-owned hospital in Wilmer. Dr. Thurber, a radiologist, and myself were involved with this. And we came up with some rather interesting results that I think are pertinent to our particular issue today. Now, this is what it involves. It involves, it's not like it's an MRI or something, which is a closed tube. The patient has the infusion of the radioisotope labeled glucose, and then they simply lie still for about 20 or 30 minutes and we get an image. And the reason that they have to lie still for that time is we use as low radiation dosage as possible so that it takes a while to build up the image. So it's a little bit like the old daguerreotype pictures where, you know, nobody smiled because you can't hold a smile for 30 seconds. It's quite non-invasive, and quite patients are able to tolerate that without a lot of discomfort. Now, this is the standard MRI. It's an image that I got at Rice Hospital, and this is a population of 20,000. So this technology is available in rural areas. And as you can see, this has tremendous detail anatomically. But again, what the meaning of this is in terms of how this person's brain is functioning is not at all clear. Now, there are various parts of the brain that are localized to specific functions, and that's important to note, so even though I won't go into a lot of detail, but there's a certain area that is sort of involved with language. So even if you put a little tiny thermometer patch on my head, you'd find out that my left hemisphere is a little bit hotter than the right hemisphere because I'm speaking right now and using language, and language is based in the left hemisphere. And so we can really find out in terms of what parts of the brain are active and which parts are sort of what functions might be compromised and which ones aren't. Now, this is again an image just to show you the relative sensitivity of this type of technology. But this was a patient that had sustained a TBI 4 months before this imaging study was done. And the patient, after being discharged, completing rehab and being certified as being ready to go home and doing well, reappeared in the emergency room having delusional symptoms and anxiety kinds of problems, sort of a primarily psychiatric disorder. So these scans were done. As you can see, the one on the left is the CT scan. That would be read by any radiologist probably in the state as being completely normal. And there are certain types of MRI scans that can be done that show, you can see there's a little bit of scar tissue in those two MRIs, particularly on the FLIR MR, where there's a little bit of clouding. But on the SPECT scan, as you can see, almost the whole left hemisphere of the brain, which shows up on the right side of the image, and the reason for that is so doctors can charge higher fees because they can screen out people that don't know how to read these things, so they reverse everything from what you think. No, actually, the reason is that the feet are towards it. So, but also a lot of blood flow is missing in the frontal lobe. So this is a patient that brain is actually much more compromised. The function of that brain is much worse than we would be lulled into thinking by just doing a CAT scan. I can't tell you how many times people have been evaluated in my emergency room, and older people in nursing homes that have fallen, kids that have had head injuries, people that are in motor vehicle accidents, where they just do a CAT scan. And unless there's a brain hemorrhage there or they have a tumor, that's going to be missed. On the other hand, the brain might not be functioning worth a darn. So basically, we're interested with this population of Iraq and Afghan returning veterans in how the brain is functioning. We don't really care what it looks like. Now, this is a normal SPECT scan. I should orient you because I do have to remind myself that everybody's used to looking at these kind of images. And as you can tell, this might as well be an image of Mars or something that I'm showing you here. But this is a normal scan, and what these are, they're shown in the same way as CAT scans or MRIs. So they're slices through. You can do axial slices, which are from the base of the head up to the top of the head. You can do coronals, which are sort of bread slices. And then you can do sagittal slices, which are from one side of the head to the other. And you can get different kinds of information depending on what scan is done. And this is a normal scan. And what you see there is, it looks like there's a hole in the brain, but actually what that is, there's the ventricular fluid, which is filled with cerebrospinal fluid, and there's also white matter. Those are not very metabolically active. And so the areas that are picking up the glucose and the radioisotope and showing up on the image are really in the cerebral cortex. So that's what appears as that sort of orange glowing nimbus around the brain. And this is fairly normal. Now, there is a bright spot there that's in the visual area. And even if a person's eyes are closed or they're dreaming, that area is active. But basically, it's symmetric. It looks kind of like a football that's well inflated. And Now, this is an example of a SPECT scan that's done with a patient that's had a serious head injury. And I'm not going to try to make you into experts in reading these, but basically you can see right away, and as opposed to that other brain, the elliptical outline of the image is disrupted. It looks like there's a major rent in the brain tissue, and the whole brain looks a lot more moth-eaten. This is actually the brain SPECT scan of an individual that was in a car accident when he was 16, became paraplegic. He was involved in lots of surgeries to stabilize his vertebral column, developed addictions to pain medication as often as the case, went through chemical dependency treatment, and eventually ended up in an outstate area where he would regularly sort of become paranoid, barricade himself in. He thought, for instance, he was personally responsible for 9/11. He thought people were trying to burglarize his place. And then he would be shipped into Wilmer, where he'd be stabilized for a few days on the psychiatric unit and tried on various medications, which never seemed to be very successful. And now this patient was not assessed completely until I took over his care. He kept bouncing back, so I said, I'm going to do a SPECT scan on him. It's one of the first ones I did out at Rice Hospital. And when I saw this finding, I wanted him to go up to the state facility for brain injury, which is at Brainerd. And the way the system works is basically if you're in a small hospital and you're having problems that can't be resolved there, you go into a commitment process and you have to go into the state system. I made two efforts to try to get him into those services. Both times I was overruled by the doctor that was on duty there, and the patient was discharged with a personality disorder on no medications. The last time that I met this gentleman, I was on rounds in the morning covering the ICU, and I recognized his name, and he had actually become quite paranoid and psychotic, tried to hang himself, and then it stuck an 8-inch perforated knife through his pericardium, and then he had to be air-vacced to Hennepin County Medical Center. So this just kind of goes to show what happens when we don't get it right. These are just other imaging studies of people with a sustained traumatic brain injuries. This is a 73-year-old man who was living in assisted living. He was starting to have some behavioral problems. He was referred over to me. I started him on a little bit of medication called risperidol, which is often kind of used empirically by psychiatrists for aggressive behavior. That didn't seem to do much good, so the assistant came in with him and said, well, we need a behavioral plan. So I said, well, you know, before we come up with a behavioral plan, first of all, I wouldn't know how to write one. That would be Dr. Thurber's domain. But second of all, why don't we find out what's causing the behavior to begin with? And so I did a little bit more history taking, and I found out that this gentleman, when he was in his 20s, had been in a major head injury situation involving a car accident. And when I did the SPECT scan, as you can see, a large part of his brain is actually missing. And the parts of the brain are missing really helped us to understand why his behavior was the way it was. And I won't go into more detail. And just a lot of these kinds of things that we've done. This is the brain of somebody that ended up in a group home. She was driving across New York State, and she came down with a viral illness that turned into a herpes encephalitis, and she ended up in a group home, a really tragic case. But as you can see, the virus has basically caused that whole area that looks blue over there on the right side of your screen to become dysfunctional. This is a patient that, by the way, had an almost normal CAT scan and MRI. That's what it looks like. This is a patient that has frontotemporal dementia. This is a dementia process that's often seen with patients that have had head injuries involving the frontal lobe. And as you can see, the front of the brain there is largely decreased. This is somebody that was a boxer. He actually had a sense of humor. He mentioned he wasn't a very good boxer. But as you can see, his brain looks real moth-eaten. And he was a gentleman that was doing quite well until his mid-40s. He had a job as sort of a supervisor for maintenance and engineering at a school, and he started having problems doing his job. He was getting confused and not able to sort of remember where he was supposed to go and things like that. He came onto our ward, and at first, I mean, he seemed extremely anxious. He was having kind of seizureoid activity that and all the nursing staff thought he was a personality disorder and said he was being manipulative. Well, we did the brain scan, and as you can see, he's got multiple areas of damage to the brain. And a lot of these troops that are coming back that have sustained multiple blast injuries are likely to have this type of pattern in terms of their brain function. And as with this gentleman, it may be a long delay between the time that they've actually sustained the injury and before it starts to compromise their performance. And I won't go into any more of those. So basically what we have is it's kind of essentially an engineering problem. I mean, I think one could look at the whole issue that all of you in the legislature face as sort of an engineering problem, no matter what the issue is. And when an engineer deals with any kind of a problem, let's say, you know, developing a spacecraft system in the Apollo era, you need to have sort of a culture of research, test, verify, in-house technical capability, hands-on activity, accept some risk and failure, have open communication, belief that you're staffed by exceptional people, attend to detail, but keep a frontier of the flight mentality. In this particular area, there's more that's not known than is known. So we can't move towards bureaucratic sorts of approaches to this. We really need to keep this as more of an Apollo-era frontiers of flight mentality. And the other thing is that every decision that you make is going to involve some sort of a compromise. You could certainly assure when you send a spacecraft up that you have 100% assurance that safety is met. But on the other hand, the more safety precautions you build in, the higher the cost is going to be of that particular system working. So, you know, it always involves compromise. But I do think that we're in an era with regard to this rapidly emerging field. And one of the reasons I didn't want to just stay with the report is even since that report was written, which was just months ago, there's been a tremendous amount of information that's been coming out. But I think we need to really maintain a position more like cavalry than in trained infantry. And the fact of the matter is a lot of the appropriate treatments are still unknown, and there's a lot of research going on. Medications. I mean, since I started working in this field 3 years ago, have often talked to drug reps about medications for traumatic brain injury, and they uniformly will tell me that all pharmacologic agents that they're dealing with are off-label for traumatic brain injury. Even though we have 1.5 million Americans a year that have a traumatic brain injury, and a lot of these people are being treated for those kinds of conditions with these kinds of drugs, we don't really know how they work with these types of things. There's some studies that are being done at the University of Minnesota using hyperbaric oxygen treatment. There are some indications that diet may be helpful in preventing the sort of progression of some of these kinds of things, avoiding high sugar and high saturated fat foods. Curry seems, interestingly enough, to help with memory and learning, and come to think of it, I do know some Indian physicists that seem to have remarkable memories. Omega-3 fish oil seem to be helpful in preventing the development of beta amyloid, which is a plaque that's associated with Alzheimer's. There are some drugs that have been used. And this is interesting. Very recent research showing that a certain molecule in breast milk seems to improve the functioning of people with dementia, stroke, and TBI. So there are all these kinds of things that are emerging. But I personally think that the most promising kinds of treatments are really going to involve rehabilitation therapies. And there's a tremendous amount of opportunity. You know, if somebody has a stroke, for instance, if it particularly involves their speech and language areas, what do? We don't put them on a bunch of medications and say, I think grandpa's kind of talking a bit strange and I think we should send him up to the mental health unit for a while. No, we assume that the person has had a brain injury that involves this area in the left hemisphere that controls speech. They often will also have a right arm that's limp. And we put them through physical therapy and speech therapy because we know that the brain has a tremendous amount of resiliency. And so the one thing that's true about the brain is you either use it or you lose it. And so if we can exercise the brain in those areas of function that are lost, we can help the brain to recover a lot of that function. And so this is a gentleman that had a head injury that's using a puzzle type of thing to regain his spatial kinds of coordination. You know, video game-based programs, similar to driving simulators, can be developed that would specifically be able to exercise those parts of the brain where there's function that's compromised. And that would present a tremendous area for research and development and also would greatly cut the cost of rehabilitation, because then you could customize that rehabilitation treatment to the individual person without having to have a individual therapist that would be working with that person as you would with typically is the case in a physical therapy or an occupational therapy or speech therapy setting. So there's a tremendous amount of optimism about these kinds of things. So finally, just to kind of wind up here, how do we respond? The statistics suggest that brain injuries are undiagnosed and underdiagnosed. A lot of these people, as the system currently exists, are going to be shunted into all of these other settings which we talked about, including primarily mental health. And because of the traditional split between physical and mental health systems, the response to TBI, which really is the bridge between these two domains, is going to remain problematic. In Willmar, where I'm currently living and have practiced for quite a number of years, we have a multi-specialty medical center that has 120 physicians, and all specialties are represented except one, psychiatry. So we need to bridge that gap. We need to get beyond the sort of mind-body split, and we need to realize that the mind is a manifestation of the brain, which is a part of the body, and that the body's health and the brain's health are all going to go together. And that those things, if we have a sound mind and a sound brain and a sound body, we're probably going to also have a sound mind and a sound spirit. Now again, there's some urgency about this. These guys are coming back to us now. And as many of you know, a lot of them are already starting to have some significant problems. So we can't afford to have the time lag that we've typically had between when these sorts of things are researched and when they become available and adopted in the field. And this is particularly the case in rural centers. Typically, when new findings are achieved at our multi-specialty centers, tertiary care centers, research universities, there's a time lag of years or even in rural areas, decades between when those things are found out and when they actually get applied in the field. So we need to speed up the transfer of technology from research into settings where they can actually start to work their wonders on people. And we also can't afford to have all of this stuff completely worked out in terms of we need to be innovative and we need to be experimental and we have to try stuff and see where the promising leads are. We can't wait for 30 years for the magic drug, because by then these people are going to be suffering from dementia and a lot of other kinds of problems. These problems are going to be with us for a long time. There was a report that was done by some very highly rated people at Harvard and Columbia, estimating that over the next 20 years that could cost as much as $14 billion to take care of the TBI veterans. Personally, I think that's an underestimate. But on the other hand, when we consider the fact that it costs $1 million to train and equip one troop for combat, I think we owe these people something when they come back from the service. A challenge for the TBI, we have a shortage of TBI-trained healthcare professionals, and particularly those that are in rural areas. So what we're sort of thinking about, and this, of course, is just a very sketchy kind of a plan, but I would suggest that we consider, and Dr. Thurber and I have talked about this a bit, that we try to think of at least one or perhaps a multiple set of small clinics that would work on promising ideas, provide innovative research, develop new technology, and foster the rapid transfer of expertise, including training to areas where it's desperately needed. And that's why I really do think we need a facility like this in a rural area. And this is a place where people could actually work with patients in the setting that would be the most comfortable to them. We could have a highly motivated and well-equipped group of professional people that would enjoy working in this kind of field, but typically would not be recruitable for rural areas because obviously we've not had that type of a facility in a rural area before. We would also be able to do research on veterans in situ where they in their own habitat, and this could also be a center that would work as a clearinghouse of information so that rural physicians, rural nurses, rural mental health physicians could contact people at this facility to get advice, to get training, and be able to receive it that way rather than trying to navigate the rather unruly system of trying to access the University of Minnesota's resources or the VA hospital in the city. So I think small is beautiful in this case, something that's very flexible, very versatile, and has a research component and also has an outreach component would be exquisite. And I think that it should be considered that public-private partnerships may be appropriate, as the Brain Injury Association of America has suggested. I think that there's a tremendous opportunity here for developing new technologies and things like that. So this could also be a spur to rural economic development, although, of course, that would not be its primary need. In conclusion, let me just say, given that traumatic brain injury has been called the silent epidemic and that the effects thereof may not immediately be apparent, we require the commitment of resources and incredible resourcefulness and will to create a resilient, flexible, and responsive system for identifying and caring effectively for the complex and evolving problems of the brain-injured veterans, and I would emphasize, if possible, in the areas where they live. Because this is my own experience, that these are rural folks, and they're sort of out there developing problems, they're going to be very reluctant to go to the Minneapolis VA or the St. Cloud VA to seek help for their problems. The system has to be designed not just to house them. I mean, this is, we're moving away from a traditional nursing home model here, but to help them rehabilitate. I think that what I would see is a small unit that would maybe have 30, 45, or 60 beds. These are people that would come for intensive diagnostic evaluations and intensive rehabilitation to make those people as much as possible capable of returning to the lives that they want to continue to lead. And if they need to be housed, and some of them will, then they can be housed elsewhere. We already have infrastructure to house veterans who have long-term needs. But I think what we need is something that's going to be much more at the front end. And the goal would be to keep them from tragically drifting into broken relationships, chronic unemployment, dependence, addictions, mental institutions, nursing homes, prisons, and homeless shelters. And I conclude with comments that were made by Abraham Lincoln at the end of the Civil War when he gave his second inaugural. But I think we really do owe it to them to attempt insofar as humanly possible to bind up the nation's wounds and to care for him who has borne the battle. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much, doctors. As members can see, this report is it's lengthy, but it's worth reading, and certainly now I think worth sharing and understanding. And that's where now it's our charge as committee members, legislators, representatives of veterans around the state to decide which direction and how we're going to address these emerging situations and problems that we'll be facing. Again, what I took from the report is, number one, the signature injury of Iraq and Afghanistan is traumatic brain injury, TBI. I think that's something people don't realize, and I think it behooves us to start educating across Minnesota. That's the key to this report. But then we have to consider this report as we plan forward. And Senator Langseth, I know you've been busy today with bonding stuff, but we're glad you're here because not necessarily in the governor's proposal, but certainly in what may come from the legislature and what actually the old Veterans Homes Board and the Veterans Department had put together previous, there are projects being asked for around the state. But I think as we plan, we need to understand how can we incorporate some of these new ideals into those new structures, whether it's, for example, Fergus Falls is asking for an Alzheimer's unit. Well, maybe they need an Alzheimer's unit, but maybe we need to think about rehab space or clinic space up there for area veterans before we build that and incorporate that in, or other facilities that we build. So I'm seeing that we need clinical rehab type space. We need research considerations, again, working hopefully with our universities and others on that, and then domiciliary, or for short or longer term care for some of these folks. And then there's no one site for this in rural Minnesota either. As we know, it's mainly in rural Minnesota. I know Senator Kubley and Conan have a VA facility in Montevideo, which I don't know why we wouldn't try and work with our federal partners for some clinical aspects there in association with that facility as we go forward. And obviously that's true all over the state, Laverne and Fergus and Silver Bay and whatever we can find up in northwest Minnesota. I think we have to start thinking more about how we assimilate these types of things. And by the way, this probably isn't the only thing we'll be talking about assimilating into our facilities for those returning vets. But But I just want to, I think I speak for Senator Vickerman, but we want to put the committee on notice and the department that we're looking for answers to this, and how can we be proactive and not just continue to wait, and we can see what happens if we wait. So are there questions for the clinicians? Senator Vickerman.
Pick up an idea I said earlier on today. We've got all kinds of hospitals, six brand new ones out where I live. Every county's got a brand new state-of-the-art hospital. We should probably, if we could figure it out, use that hospital to treat these veterans instead of having them coming to the cities or other parts of the state. It would be a win-win situation both for the veterans and for the community. My concern is, how much help are we going to get from the federal government? Or are they just going to say, well, yeah, we like the idea, but the money won't come along? You know, the small rural hospitals can't fund everything. They just don't have the money. We'd figure out some way so the state would maybe make part of their first initial cost. And then, but you know, and you know, Dr. Wells, I do, these patients could be there for umpteen years.
I think, we certainly had that experience, as Representative Junkie could also attest, in Wilmer. I mean, one of the goals had been at one point to incorporate one of these 16-bed CDHHs with the community hospital there, and that fell through, I think, mainly because the community hospital wasn't persuaded that it was economically viable. Mm-hmm. And they are moving instead towards putting together a first-class cancer treatment facility. And I certainly don't mean to denigrate all those efforts to help patients with cancer, but I do think that in large part those kinds of strategic decisions are based on economics. And I think if we were able to make it worth the while of these kinds of hospitals to care for these kinds of veterans, we wouldn't have any problem getting people to sign on. So I agree with you.
Questions, comments? Senator Erickson-Rolfe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the two of you more than the presenters, and thank you very much. It was an excellent, excellent presentation. I'm wondering if we have information about the demographics of veterans in the state, you know, where people are living, what physical or mental challenges that they're dealing with. So as we look at possibly some of these enhanced facilities or working partnerships between public and private, where we could target areas, because or maybe the rest of the committee knows, but I don't know where our population of veterans are.
Again, I'm looking over at the department, but I would say yes, we know. And we know also where the recruits came from, which armories, where they're returning. We have that, so we should be able to make some educated guesses on needs across the state. And again, but you heard initially, there'll be more in rural Minnesota than metro, just by fact of that's where the recruits came from.
I think that'd be a really powerful thing if we could see visually.
As we move forward, we'll be asking the department to participate in some of that. Representative Detmer.
Mr. Chairman and Dr. Sheehan, I served 20 months after 9/11. Both my sons have been over in Iraq, one for two tours. Now, what have you contacted in the military? How much screening is done after these soldiers, before they are brought back to the state? How much screening is done? I know we're very good at documenting when there's an incident of a TBI, TBI, but how much screening is done before these soldiers are brought back?
Dr. Sheehan?
Well, I'm not completely familiar. I have presented some of the work that I did at the Minneapolis VA. I think that, you know, just it, probably in a nutshell, things are getting better than they were, but I think as with our response to traumatic brain injury generally, I think we do a very, very high-level job of stabilizing patients immediately after the injury. The acute care that I understand that the military is providing is extraordinary, and that largely accounts for the fact that we're seeing, you know, such a high survival rate. But I think that the follow-up of the patients after, you know, the acute injuries have been stabilized is what's been a problem. And of course, you know, when the whole thing with Walter Reed emerged, that was really around those issues. You know, what happened to these people after, you know, sort of their acute problems had been resolved. But I'm not a representative of the VA, and I've had some informal conversations, but I can't really say what they're actually doing. I think they're doing some screening instruments, but they're moving slowly, and there are lots of research projects going on around the country, but it's sort of fragmentary and not really very well integrated, I think. So I think you're going to find a lot of local variability in terms of what's being done depending on what site you're at.
Representative Wardville.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that those who have TBI are more susceptible to contracting Alzheimer's. Is the same true for those with PTSD?
I don't think so. I don't think that's the case. It really does seem to involve some changes in the tissue of the brain that predisposes these folks for developing Alzheimer's. And I could certainly get you more technical information about the etiology of all of that if you were interested. But it seems to be really related to traumatic brain injury specifically. And another thing about traumatic brain injury that I didn't emphasize, but it seems that multiple injuries become cumulative. So the risk of developing those kinds of problems later on partly depends on how many concussions the person has had. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these soldiers are actually sustaining six or more blast injuries. Because for everyone that's actually killed, there are a lot of people that are exposed to these roadside bombs that are sustaining injuries that are quite variable, and a lot of it depends on even the particular orientation of the person at the time the blast occurred, because it really does have to do with sound, high energy sound waves that penetrate helmets and things like that and cause the brain to have all sorts of destabilizing movements, and helmets can actually exacerbate the problem, because basically in that case the head and the brain is like sort of the ringer of a bell as the bell is being rung. So it's just been a very difficult problem to deal with. But yeah, so these are people that are probably going to potentially 40, 50 years of age start developing early onset dementia. And it does raise the question of some of the treatments that we're currently using for patients that have dementia, like some of the drugs that are being used to try to help with the memory problems and that. If we started some of that sort of thing earlier on, we might be able to obviate the problem to some extent. But
Representative Dominguez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a son that had two terms in Iraq, and very proud of that. But my question is also with the family. I didn't hear too much of that in your conversation as far as family members recognizing the symptoms of this disease and the problem. Is there any information that states that not only working with the soldiers, but with the family and children? Some of them have children, as we know. Could you tell us a little bit about what can we do as, the whole family structure?
To either of you, and I think the secondary question to that is, are we doing it, or should we be doing some of that with our reintegration efforts, not only for the
right.
soldiers themselves, but the families as they're coming back, and we reintegrate with great Minnesota that's celebrated for those efforts. But, Dr. Thurber.
Well, my response would be that any kind of a problem experience, a severe problem by a returning veteran, will affect the family structure. We've already mentioned that with TBIs, the symptoms may be very subtle and may be unrecognized at first. Those symptoms are evolving and they tend to become more severe over time. There is a high risk of marital difficulties found among TBI veterans, and so that's an issue. So obviously it's affecting the family constellation, interactions within the family. The ultimate cure for a problem, be it mainly caused by difficulties with brain functioning or other causes, will be embedded in a family unit. So we know that from a variety of problem areas. These are family problems. They affect interactions within the family. They affect husbands and wives and their interactions. They affect children and their development. So I can only agree that the ultimate solution will be family-focused.
And just to ask that, and I think it would be the Senator Vickram or maybe Representative Junkie that mentioned this, but I think that we really need to educate people about these kinds of issues, because I think that for many family members, they aren't going to necessarily understand that some of these kinds of changes in loved ones may be due to a brain injury. And I think that if a person understands the root cause of it, it makes it a lot easier to deal with than if you think that they've just, it's because they're drinking or because they're, they've had some sort of a psychological problem. And I think the medical profession, the mental health system, most of us are relatively uninformed about this whole issue. And certainly family members are no different. I mean, they're typically going to respond to this stuff without having that kind of knowledge. So I think we need to do a lot of work educating people about the issue, and that will, I think, help maybe lead them towards being able to come up with more viable sorts of solutions. But the number of divorces, there was a study that showed that the number of cases of child abuse involving people was related to the length of their tours. There's just a host of problems that are going to, come from this, and I think we need to understand why these people are having the problems rather than blaming the victim and sort of telling us that they had the problems before they entered the service.
Another brief comment is we do have research having to do with the caregivers of children. When a caregiver experiences a major disruption in his or her life, it affects the quality of disciplinary techniques. So children may not be as monitored as effectively as they would have been without the problem in the caregiver, for example. Or the disciplinary techniques may become erratic. So there have been long-term studies showing that children suffer indirectly in the long range because disciplinary techniques are affected.
Very good. All right, members, doctors, we appreciate you being here, members of the audience, department, and we have no further business today, but we will be hitting the ground running the second week in February on these and other issues. So thank you for your time, your attention. Spread the good word. Meeting adjourned.